You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
This week on Talk Nation Radio, we'll speak with Robert Alvarez about nominations and witch hunts at the Department of Energy. But first, we continue our conversation with Vincent Emmanuel, veteran and anti-war activist. He was just talking about oil companies.
I've either been fighting for or fighting against oil companies, I feel like, since I was 18 years old, David. So
yeah.
It's sort of sick to say that out loud, but that was, you know, as I'm sure you know, spending time around activists in general, but also veterans and so on. I mean, there's sort of a dark sense of humor you have to sometimes deal with these things. And that was the sense I got from a lot of the veterans. I mean, in a more serious way, they understood they were sent to fight and potentially die and be forever altered physically, emotionally, mentally.
Yeah.
For oil, you know, corporations and geopolitical interests. That was very clear. They very clearly understood their place in this battle now against the oil companies. And I hope you're right. I mean, here where I'm at in Northwest Indiana, this sort of Rust Belt, deindustrialized area, there, I mean, we deal a lot with unions. So not only do we want the unions to step up and take on U.S. empire and so on and deal with the contradiction of their own, you know, relationship within that framework. But also, you know, we're looking for them to combat the very industries that they see as providing jobs. So we have the British Petroleum tar sands refinery here in East Chicago, Hammond, Indiana. And it's, as some workers have described it, a ticking time bomb. And that's just in that regard. I mean, we've just on a daily basis, the kind of pollution and the kind of industry and the environmental racism that plays such a huge role in putting that plant in a largely black and brown area. These are issues we're dealing with, obviously, internationally and nationally, but even locally, you know, no less than 20 miles from where I'm talking to you right now.
We're speaking with Vincent Emmanuel. He's been to North Dakota and is an activist based in Indiana. You know, we now have a climate related to, you know, climate issues where the president-elect, so-called, is proposing for Secretary of State the CEO of Exxon, which is being investigated by attorneys general in multiple states for lying to the public for 40 years about climate change, an all-out climate denier to run the EPA, and a questionnaire sent by the Trump transition team around to all staff of the Department of Energy trying to identify anyone who's, you know, ever been to any meeting related to acknowledging the existence of climate change.
Yeah, I just heard that today.
It's some sort of witch hunt, you know, it looks like. How is this sort of stuff and similar on the issue of war and empire, how are things going to change for anti-war activism and other activism in the coming months?
Well, I think we have to learn some lessons. I think from what I'm young to this. As I mentioned earlier, I got involved when I was about 22. It's about 10 years ago now. I've tried to learn from people who have been great mentors, and I've tried to take my personal experiences and then read about former social movements and what's happening now and traveling around the world and working with movements abroad too and seeing some of these similarities. And I have to say that I think we have to learn some great lessons from the Bush era. This would be something I would be interested in interviewing you and others about. I would like to say that I think there needs to be like maybe a volume or two volumes of books that need to be probably published about the kinds of lessons that were learned under the Bush era, when there was, I think, a pretty vibrant anti-war movement. And people forget, I mean, we had an Iraq Veterans Against the War office in Chesterton, Indiana, a town of 14,000 people. So to give people an idea, and I think obviously you would understand this as much, if not more than anyone else, the kind of funding, the kind of support from allies, the kind of involvement that it takes to sustain an office. and we had an office in a town of 14,000 people for 2 years, specifically just to do anti-war work. We had city councils locally, places like Gary, Indiana, South Bend, that passed resolutions against the war in Iraq. And we can go on and on. I mean, we were talking to local high schools and middle schools and so on. There was a lot of good work. But, you know, as you know and I know, it was a great heartbreak. And when 2008 happened, when Obama took office, when many of the people I know who had been involved sort of went home, it broke my heart. And so I think we have to learn from that. You know, how much education did we really do for people? You know, how can we build better organizations? How can we have a bigger vision? You know, other than I think looking back, a lot of it was just anti-Bush, anti sort of Cheney, like these individuals or these people as symbols. I worry that we see the same thing with Trump. I don't want this to become an anti-Trump movement. I think we need a movement to oppose U.S. empire. And we need to, I think, be able to express to people and to tell people, as many people are going to now find out, after not criticizing Obama for 7 or 8 years, well, guess what? Now all of the powers and all of the things that people who had been critical of Obama warned of that gaining, especially power within the executive branch, now all of those powers are going to be bestowed to Trump's administration. You know, those are lessons we can learn. I think the left became more critical of Obama, and progressives and even some liberals became more critical of Obama as time went on. I think that was another reason why Hillary Clinton couldn't get the kind of support she got. You know, I think people are kind of tired, and I can tell you this from being in a Rust Belt area, that, you know, people are kind of tired of the identity politics. They want to hear a vision, a platform that stands for something. And as much as I was very critical of Bernie Sanders because of his foreign policy record, because of his so-called foreign policy vision, although I think we'd both agree it was better than Clinton's and Trump's, but nowhere near adequate and nowhere near where I would like to see a candidate's foreign policy position. What interested me with Sanders' campaign was much less him or even his opportunities for winning, but the kind of people it brought out in my hometown and in these areas that I never see people around, David. I mean, these are people, some people I hadn't seen since the Bush era, and then people I had never met. I mean, we've been doing work in this area for a decade. So in that way, it was clear to me that if we had an anti-war platform added to a social democratic platform, if you want to call it a socialist platform, I think a lot of people in my area would still go for it. If we could add a foreign policy dynamic to that, and if we could give a clear vision, not just, hey, we're against this war or that war, because as you know, people are against the Iraq war, but for all kinds of different reasons. But if we could give a clear, principled position that we are against U.S. empire, and here's why, and here's the alternative, I think we can start to build the kind of organizations and institutions we need. And I think that also, to end this long-winded answer, I also think that needs to be outside of the NGO structure. A lot of the most interesting activism that I see right now are people who are creating independent organizations. And I think that's important for us to do that.
Well, I think that fits with what we're trying to do at worldbeyondwar.org and what other organizations are trying to do. I wonder how we can get masses of people enthusiastically behind a policy platform in the absence of a big party presidential candidate talking about it. And I also wonder whether people now, when Trump takes over the power to murder people with drones and the power to spy and imprison and torture and so forth, whether people are going to now get upset about what they've sat still for President Obama doing for 8 years, or whether having accepted it in the back of their minds for 8 years and avoided thinking about it, they're now going to tolerate it as normal and not get outraged the way they might have 5 or 6 years ago had it been a Republican doing it.
Well, the first question in terms of organizing people outside of outside of a presidential campaign and so on, I totally agree with you. I think what's been difficult for a lot of us to sort of bounce back and forth from going into communities and now, I think, thinking about community organizing in a different way. You know, one of my great friends, I just interviewed him 2 weeks ago, is a gentleman by the name of Roberto Jesus Clack, who works in the Pilsen neighborhood, the south side of Chicago, southwest side of Chicago, doing a lot of the kind of work that I think a lot of people should be doing, this door-to-door activism, getting together with community businesses, getting together with community leaders and so on, and really getting to know your neighborhood and your community in a much deeper way than I've seen a lot of movements operate. And for them, you know, we always have this discussion. So they're working on different issues that people can identify immediately, privatization, charter schools, and so on. But at the same time, it's been hard to incorporate a deeper message. And even if the message does resonate, so if you can incorporate education about imperialism, U.S. empire, and let's say the organization and the community level here in the south side of Chicago agrees with those positions or with that sort of worldview, then taking it to the next step for policy. I think this is where the major question is for us, for people who are interested in either rebuilding, building a new anti-war movement, is how do we get people who aren't primarily interested in those things, maybe engaged with other movements, which is, I think, the period that we've been in. And I see the same thing. You're going back to Australia here in the spring, and I saw the same thing last year, where there just wasn't really much interest in the anti-war movement. Other movements are thriving, though. You know, so down there in Australia, environmental movement, thriving, great things happening, building membership, numbers getting bigger, people becoming more sophisticated in their actions, becoming more radical in their actions, great stuff. I would also argue same thing here in the United States. The Standing Rock event, for me, does provide maybe a launching pad for connecting those issues, and I think that conduit will be the veterans community. How that's done, I think then remains the question, you know, what kind of organizations do we want to build? I'm not sure if the existing organizations, in the way that they're modeled and so on, and their tradition, are the way to go, or maybe new organizations. You know, I'm always trying to encourage people to be as creative as possible. So if something's not working after years and years and years of doing it, then obviously, I mean, to me, it means that we have to try some new things. It doesn't mean that we're not going to retain some basic principles or some fundamental lessons that have to be learned or have been learned.
Yeah.
But to just try new ways of doing things. And, you know, one of the things I saw in the anti-war movement throughout the years was sort of a lack of that real rooted grassroots politics. There was a lot of conventions, a lot of conferences. I was flying around and driving around to all 50 states, going to events and so on. And often I would feel this sort of void when I would come home, because even though we had an office and even though we were doing good work, you know, I couldn't really go to my neighbors and talk about these issues. Not like I can go to them now and talk about the domestic issues that are, I think, on the table for a lot of people. And, part of this, I think, has to be intentional. How do we intentionally educate people who have been turned on by Stein, by Sanders, by others? And then how do we expand that vision, which for the Sanders campaign was primarily a domestic vision, to incorporate the kinds of things that someone like you have been working on for many years. I mean, this,
yeah,
that to me, Standing Rock, the veterans, Native communities, the environmental movement, I see that as being the avenue. I don't think it's through unions or traditional organized labor or the traditional liberal groups.
Sometimes, Vince, I wear my shirts that say things like, I'm already against the next war, and war, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing, and so forth. And I find that the people, and random people, all walks of life, who are open to the idea, will start conversations with me, you know, and where can I get one of those shirts? So I try to wear the message as much as possible, but it is endless hard work. We've got just 1 minute left.
Well, even Trump's messaging. So part of it is completely reactionary and ideologically opposed and, mm-hmm. and to our values and so on. But there's a part of it as well, if you remember in the primaries, constantly talking about how the war in Iraq was a mistake, how the war in Afghanistan is a disaster. There is a sentiment, even among his supporters, those who aren't rabid racists and xenophobes, that I think can be organized. And I think some of what Nader's talked about with Ron Paul, I think, applies here. There's a libertarian strain that I think we can tap into, and I think there's a new strain of people who support Stein and Sanders and even critical supporters of Clinton who we can tap into, and even some of Trump's people. I think the sentiment is there. For me, it's a matter of organizing and us finding people who hold similar values to put the time and effort into actually doing the hard work of day-to-day organizing.
I think that's exactly right, and a message a lot of capital D Democrats need to hear right now. Vincent Emmanuel, thank you very much for everything you're doing and for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks for everything you do, man.
It's now my privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio Robert Alvarez. He is a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and an adjunct professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced Strategic International Studies. He's considered one of the nation's preeminent experts on civilian and military nuclear programs. Between 1993 and 1999, Alvarez served as senior policy advisor to the U.S. Secretary of Energy. And between 1988 and 1993, he served on the majority staff of the U.S. Senate Committee on Governmental Affairs, which was chaired by Senator John Glenn. Robert Alvarez, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Thanks for coming on. Two topics, if we can fit them in. One is this questionnaire that was sent to the Department of Energy by apparently the Trump transition team. Who sent it? What was its purpose? And was it successfully resisted and blocked? And is that a model for resistance in the permanent government in Washington?
Well, I mean, I've experienced two or three transitions when I was working in government, and this kind of stuff is not surprising, but, I mean, in terms of process itself, because transition teams are there to figure out what's going on with an agency, and especially if a change in party, they want to know, well, who are the people that are political appointees and who are, you know, but what makes this qualitatively different was their questionnaire, 74 questions that they posed, which some of which were just quite simply out of hand and invasive, you know, especially asking for the identity, locations, et cetera, backgrounds of those people who are involved in climate change policy. And to the credit of the department, the Obama administration, they refused to supply the names. And even the, you know, the Trump transition team has backed away from this questionnaire now because of the you know, sort of blowback they got, explaining that they hadn't authorized the memo and the employee had been counseled who sent it. But I think what's also interesting is that, or the other questions that they asked, and, you know, I can sort of go through some of the things that they, that I kind of surmised they're looking to do here. They want to identify federal and contractor employees invited in climate change activities they probably want to, you know, marginalize or get rid of. And, you know, to the credit of the Obama administration, they won't provide these names. What I read into what they're trying to do is they want to freeze all new federal hires, set the stage for layoffs. They want to curtail the department's renewable energy and conservation programs. They want to figure out the department's sort of contracting maze, which no one has been able to figure out. They want to reduce cleanup spending at the contaminated nuclear weapons sites, which now runs at around $6 billion per year and has a total estimated liability of about $400 billion. This is the largest, most expensive complex environmental cleanup program. They'd like to try to figure out a way to restart the process of opening the Yucca Mountain nuclear waste disposal site for spent power reactor fuel.
Yeah.
They definitely want to spend more money on nuclear research and development for small modular reactors. I mean, this agency, however, if you sort of step back and look at it from, in terms of where the money is going already, nuclear research and development is consuming about 40% of all our energy R&D money as it is. About $2 billion a year. So I'm not sure that, you know, that throwing more money at nuclear is going to, you know, make a big of a difference. They also want to figure out a way to stem the accelerating closure of aging, uneconomical nuclear power plants, which I don't think you can throw money at that problem. I mean, this is a problem that will involve just blatant congressional bailouts and saddling ratepayers with additional costs that would offset the costs that these guys have to make up in terms of competing with natural gas.
Yeah.
They definitely want to muzzle the Energy Information Administration and eliminate any analysis regarding carbon emissions. And they're questioning whether the Energy Department's national laboratories, there are about 17 of these laboratories, whether they've engaged in research that ushered in commercial achievements.
So how does this agenda fit with throwing out the name of Rick Perry, the guy who, though he couldn't remember it, wanted to abolish the Department of Energy?
Well, I think it's not just Rick Perry. It's the Trump team altogether. And the lack of basic, understanding of the basic and fundamental elements of the department itself. Getting rid of the Energy Department, which was one of Rick Perry's campaign promises, although he couldn't remember the name of the agency when he was running for president at that time, has been to political conservatives what the great white whale was to Captain Ahab in Herman Melville's novel Moby Dick. This particular cry to get rid of the department has been around for almost 40 years. I mean, I recall Ronald Reagan in 1980 when he was running for president vowing to get rid of this agency on the list of short things he was going to do as soon as he got in the office. And very soon after his election, he met this great white whale and realizing the department's primary function was to make and maintain a nuclear arsenal, he decided to steer his ship away from it.
Yeah, this is a little bit strange that, an administration like every other U.S. administration that wants yet more militarism, wants to demolish an agency that is, like so many others, primarily military.
I don't think they grasp the extent and degree to which this agency is dominated by military nuclear spending. I mean, if you look at the nuclear infrastructure, and there are other parts of the department infrastructure that are very important, but if you look at the entire department infrastructure, it has a land base greater than the states of Rhode Island and Delaware combined. And the Energy Department is responsible for the largest government-owned research and industrial complex in the United States. And in several western and southern states, this sprawling complex is a dominant economic force that can make or break statewide elections. Now, under the Obama administration, the department has also become an important player in energy policy, especially in terms of its loan programs and its effort to promote efficient automobiles and better ways to generate electricity. But I don't think the Trump transition team, probably not former Governor Perry, have a clue of how the department fits together. And that memo pretty much reflects that lack of understanding. They've ignored the fact that nearly two-thirds of the budget goes for military nuclear spending and that this budget area has been experiencing out-of-control cost escalation. And what I read into their questions is that they are adopting pretty much the Heritage Foundation's agenda of supporting fossil fuels, cutting back on the workforce, stamping out climate change research and development, trying to stave off collapse of the nuclear power industry, and cutting funds for environmental cleanup. That indicates to me how little they know about the department. These are pieces that they don't like or they want to change. They don't mention such rather important matters such as disposition of huge stockpiles of nuclear weapons materials that we have to deal with and radioactive waste. The Power Marketing Administration's Bonneville Power, for example, is under the rubric of the Energy Department, which manages electrical generation projects providing electricity to wide swaths of the western United States. There's the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, the Naval Nuclear Propulsion Program, which manages the country's Navy reactors, and the National Nuclear Security Administration's nonproliferation efforts. So it sort of reflects this level of narrow view of tunnel vision of what this agency is all about without doing their homework. All this information that I'm relaying to you, by the way, is all publicly available on the Internet. This isn't some sort of secret that only the agency bureaucrats can reveal to the transition team.
It's not an example
of how political ideology and laziness has come to play in a very heavy-handed way without regard for what it really means to run an agency or what this agency is all about.
It does seem like one of the results of having nuclear weapons be under the so-called Energy Department is that people don't know they're there and give the price tag of U.S. militarism as much smaller than it is by just looking at the Department of War, the department that was, you know, renamed and misnamed the Department of Defense.
Well, I think the history of this, people don't recognize what the history is of the Department
of Energy.
How it was created. Well, the reason the Department of Energy was created out of the abolition of the Atomic Energy Commission, which was responsible for the design, development, testing of the nuclear arsenal. And it's always been that way. So when the Energy Department was created, non-nuclear activities were sort of grafted onto this very large infrastructure. And nuclear weapons has always been a dominant feature of the Energy Department since its creation in the late 1970s. It's just that when most people that, you know, most people, especially people that aren't attuned to paying attention to government functions, when they think about Department of Energy, they think about, you know, electricity, natural gas, oil, nuclear, whatever. What they don't realize is that when, you know, you get a lot of people, especially I've seen this happen in some cases, when energy secretaries take over who don't quite understand what this agency's about. So one of the first things that happens once they're sworn in is that they bring out what I call the budgetary handcuffs. You know, there's this roughly two-thirds of the budget goes for bombs, nuclear weapons, and this large infrastructure that's necessary to maintain this arsenal. It's about 7,000 weapons.
Which is, of course, not necessary.
From the public, you know, I don't know, the argument of this being, you know, sort of another hidden cost of militarism, well, that has a grain of truth to it, but it's not, this fact is not lost on the U.S. Congress, you know, that the way they've structured the way spending is. I mean, because...
No, I meant the U.S. public, not the U.S. Congress. There's a difference.
Well, the public doesn't know, but also a lot of elected officials and people who are,
we've got less than a minute. Less than a minute left. Robert, is Congress going to go along with Rick Perry's nomination and with this agenda?
I don't see any. I don't see any opposition mounting to his nomination. I think that that they'll go along with this, and so because it sort of fits into the larger scheme of the Trump agenda on energy. In many respects, the Energy Department is not that big of a player in energy policy. It really its major function is to maintain its large infrastructure of energy R&D, which is mostly dominated by things nuclear. So, you know, the real players in energy policy, in my opinion, are the EPA and the Interior Department, which presides over a large portion.
I'm afraid we will have to leave it there, and I wish they meant it more when they say abolishing that infrastructure. Robert Alvarez from the Institute for Policy Studies, thank you very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, a Trump presidency requires vigilance on many fronts, but the human rights of half the population should be high on the list. The thing is, for corporate media, abortion access is primarily a hot topic rather than a material fact of life for women and families. We'll talk about the human beings involved in the fight for reproductive rights with Destiny Lopez of the group All Above All. Also on the show, even if Trump, who lost the popular vote, had not won the presidency, his campaign had already had an impact. Reports of hate crimes in which Trump is evoked suggest that racists, sexists, and xenophobes feel emboldened. How can reporters address this phenomenon? We'll talk about how they can and why they must with journalist A.C. Thompson from ProPublica. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a quick look back at the week's press. The December 19th New Yorker carries a piece by Malcolm Gladwell in which he compares Edward Snowden unfavorably to Daniel Ellsberg, in part because Ellsberg went to better schools. Quote, Snowden did not study under a Nobel Prize winner or give career advice to the likes of Henry Kissinger. He was a community college dropout, a member of the murky hacking counterculture. Close quote. Glenn Greenwald called out that class bias, but Fares Gymnarikas notes something more surprising, Gladwell's take on the role of anonymous leaks. In a properly functioning media system, Gladwell argues, the purpose of leaks is to fool people into accepting government indoctrination, and it would be a shame if that system were to break down. The argument is borrowed from Columbia Law professor David Posen, who, Gladwell says, argues that governments look the other way when it comes to leaks because it is in their interest to do so. Posen makes a distinction between unauthorized leaks and plants, the latter being a leak made with the full authorization of the White House. The article cites an anonymously sourced story about CIA drone strikes in Yemen. We're told that sort of plant works for the government because it, quote, keeps the American people minimally informed of its pursuits and characterizes them in a manner designed to build support, close quote. But if you want to reserve your right to plant an authorized leak, you have to allow unauthorized leaks as well. Posen writes, for a strategy of planting to work, it is critical that relevant audiences not immediately assume that every unattributed disclosure they encounter reflects a concerted White House effort to manipulate the information environment. And Gladwell adds, quote, in a world where every stealthy disclosure is a plant, the journalist is a stooge and the administration's motives are transparent. But when the origin of the disclosure is uncertain, all parties save face, close quote. Note that for Gladwell, for the government's motives to be transparent is a bad thing. If readers spot the effort to manipulate the information environment, then the government attempt to build support will fail. Likewise, being recognized as a journalistic stooge is a bad thing. An undetected stooge is not a problem. In short, Gladwell writes, quote, the relationship between the government and the press, between the source of leaks and the beneficiary of leaks, is symbiotic, close quote. In Gladwell's view, Daniel Ellsberg leaking the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times was an example of this. Quote, a studious political science PhD wishes to instruct the upper echelon of American leadership in the benefits of reading several thousand pages of history, and, after his initial efforts prove unavailing, assigns a carefully curated set of course materials to the most august institution in American journalism. This isn't the behavior of a dissident, close quote. It's funny, Ellsberg didn't see it that way, nor did Nixon, who rails against Ellsberg as a radical and part of a conspiracy against him in the Watergate tapes. For his part, Ellsberg expressed no interest in getting the upper echelons of American leadership to read the papers. He explained in an interview, quote, "The only thing that I could personally hope to achieve by my own efforts was to make these documents available to the American public for them to read and to learn from. What the Pentagon Papers told me when I read them was that the executive branch was determined not to learn lessons from its experience in Vietnam. The history in the Pentagon Papers told me that if others were to learn a different lesson, it would have to be people outside the executive branch, and they would have to have the physical capability to read the papers." Close quote. Well, despite Ellsberg's avowed interest in bringing the history of the Vietnam War to the people, Gladwell presents him as the quintessential leaker, saying leakers, quote, "are interested in using and exploiting secrecy. They believe that secrecy, by its preservation and strategic violation, serves an essential purpose." Close quote. Gladwell presents Edward Snowden as engaged in an entirely different activity. Quote, "Snowden didn't leak in the traditional sense. He flooded, and in that difference of degree is a difference in kind. A much-needed national conversation about the NSA's encroachment on civil liberties became sidetracked by debates about his own motivations." Close quote. Gladwell imagines a character named Daniel Snowberg and tells readers, quote, "Daniel Snowberg, the insider, would have sparked a national debate that focused on the question of what access the NSA should have had to the private data of ordinary American citizens. Snowberg would have stood as someone who restored the legitimacy of the national intelligence apparatus, who embarrassed the executive branch in the short term in order to preserve the prerogatives of the executive branch in the long term." Close quote. Yes, if only Snowden had been an overeducated insider who valued the preservation of secrecy and wanted only to use and exploit secrets in order to preserve government power, then we could have had a real debate about civil liberties. Instead, having tried to expose the secrets of an abusive government to the public, just like Daniel Ellsberg did, Snowden will have to wait 45 years for the inheritors of Malcolm Gladwell's style of establishment journalism to fantasize that he was an insider all along. You are listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Women's reproductive rights, never universally comfortably secure, are in clear and present danger under a Trump administration. But much media coverage of abortion has been marked by a static pro-con framing that presents it as, above all, a political football rather than a question of women's fundamental human rights. As Trump-emboldened lawmakers push forward more heartbeat bills and waiting period restrictions, we have to ask if media will rise to the challenge, including acknowledging that, as it stands, all women are not equal when it comes to the ability to make critical reproductive choices. Destiny Lopez is co-director of All Above All, a coalition of groups and individuals working to lift the bans that deny abortion coverage. She joins us now by phone from North Carolina. Welcome to Counterspin, Destiny Lopez.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Donald Trump has said he'll defund Planned Parenthood. He'll put anti-choice justices on the Supreme Court. He'll sign a 20-week abortion ban. We know that harassment at clinics is already up. There's a lot to fear and to think about here. But as with other issues, I think I hear folks saying, let's start with the most vulnerable. You know, when it comes to abortion access, who does that mean?
So I think that means the constituencies that my campaign really focuses on and cares about, women of color and young folks. They are the ones who are disproportionately impacted by any bans on abortion, restrictions of abortion, any attempts to undercut abortion access in this country ultimately are going to disproportionately impact those groups of women.
Yeah, it seems important to recognize that the rights that we're saying are in jeopardy, some women effectively don't really have them now. I think the Hyde Amendment people think of as ancient history, it's very much with us, isn't it?
It is very much with us, and it's been with us for the last 40 years. So we just marked the 40th year of the Hyde Amendment. And really, you know, Trump and Pence and now the anti-abortion leadership in Congress, since they have both houses, want to make it harder to prevent unintended pregnancy and ultimately impossible to get abortion, but they penalize women, right, for having children as well. And so we don't have to imagine what it looks like when they push it out of reach, because frankly, they already do this with Hyde.
Right.
You know, as you said, it bans insurance coverage for abortion for women enrolled in Medicaid. And again, those are brown and black folks, tend to be younger folks as well.
Well, Hyde was clear that he wanted to ban all abortion, but this was just the part that he had control over, you know, and mm-hmm. you just mentioned it, but maybe just spell out who is affected by Hyde.
Sure, sure. So if you think about who is part of the Medicaid program, obviously that's a broad swath of Americans, but disproportionately those are women of color, Black women in particular, as well as Latino women, as well as young folks are all folks who are part of that program. But now what we've seen also since Hyde was originally enshrined into law 40 years ago, all of these kind of copycat amendments have been added. So now if you're in the Peace Corps, or if you get your care through the Indian Health Service, if you're a federal employee, if you are in a federal detention center, including immigrants who are in federal detention centers, all of those groups of folks also have the same restrictions. So all of them are not allowed to use federal funds to access abortion care unless it's in the cases of the health of the mother, rape, or incest. So, you know, it went from a very small group of folks to a much larger group of folks. And, you know, we see that punishment of women that Trump said over and over in the campaign that he wanted to punish women is already happening with Hyde.
Well, the fact that these restrictions fall heaviest on low-income women is not surprising in a way, but it's not really the only way that economics and abortion are related. I mean, the ability to determine whether or not to have a child can mean the difference between falling below the poverty line or not. It seems clear, but the economic impact of abortion rights, it seems to me, is rarely explored, at least in the media.
That's right. And what we know is, particularly when it comes to the Hyde Amendment, that pushing abortion coverage out of reach of women forces one in four poor women to carry an unwanted pregnancy to term. So you have to imagine what that looks like for a woman in her real life. She likely has other children already. She might want to pursue a career or education, and that becomes further and further out of reach for women. And those are all kind of bread and butter economic issues from a woman's point of view. And we don't, I think you're right, we don't talk about that enough. And part of the work that we do at All Above All is really to make those connections. You know, we fundamentally believe that regardless of how a woman gets her insurance, how much money she makes, or where she lives, that she should have access to the same reproductive health care, including abortion, as any other woman. And so if you think about the patchwork we've now created, you know, federal funding is prohibited. There are a number of states that provide Medicaid funding through their own state funds, but that's, you know, 17 states out of our 50 states. So in those other 30 plus states, women don't have access to Medicaid coverage. So we've created this kind of uneven pattern of access throughout the country, which you also see in terms of the number of abortion providers women have, the number of restrictions that women have depending on the state that they live in. So it's just this patchwork that really ultimately comes down to how much money you make and where you live, whether you're actually going to get the care that is rightfully ours.
Which, needless to say, is not the way you manage something that is genuinely seen as a right, you know, that is seen as a human right, that access.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, I remember reading Brenda Wright from the group Demos talking about this and pointing out that something like 7 in 10 women who had abortions were saying they would have had them earlier, but their delay was due to a lack of funds, you know, and connecting, in other words, women's autonomy and economic security with, you know, we're supposedly interested in working families. Well, this is a core issue for a working family, you know, for their economic lives.
Absolutely. In a prior part of my career, I worked with an abortion fund, and we were providing daily to women who were seeking abortion care money for their procedure, or a tank of gas so they could get to that procedure, a place to stay for an overnight procedure. You know, all the scraping that women have to do to get together the money and the support that she needs, logistical and otherwise, to actually just get to access healthcare, again, that's considered a right. You know, I don't think we talk enough about that process either, what it takes for a woman, you know, both the decision-making she goes through to make that decision, and then once she's made her decision, the kind of hoops she has to go through, and a lot of them are financial, in order to actually access care.
Well, one of the shocking to many election results is that 52% of white women voted for Donald Trump. And I just read that reproductive rights groups had a strategy meeting recently and determined that women of color should take the lead in that fight. I wonder what you think about that. What's the thinking behind that recentering? It seems to me a positive development.
Yeah, I had the privilege of being at that meeting. Well, so one thing I'll say is, and I'm a Latina, so I identify as a woman of color, we have been at the leading, particularly on the issue of the Hyde Amendment. We have been at the forefront of this movement to repeal the Hyde Amendment for many, many years, but really a resurgence in that effort since All Laval came onto the scene about 5 or 6 years ago. So I think if we look at who was under attack during this election cycle, right, it was undocumented folks, Black women, men and children, Muslim Americans, low-income people, and people of color more generally. You know, those were the folks who were under attack, who Trump said vicious things about. Those are also the people who showed up at the polls, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we can look at the numbers of who didn't show up, but if we looked at who showed up, the amazing number of Black women who showed up, you know, Latinos broke for Hillary, young folks broke for Hillary. When we look at those folks, they're there with us, and we need to continue to engage those constituencies, engage our communities in dialogue about these issues, because they're also part of the new American majority. So their numbers are going to be increasing as voters, and we must be responsive to their concerns. And what that also means then is we can't just be talking about abortion access or reproductive rights in a silo. We have to come at this through a justice framework, which means we have to stand with folks fighting for racial justice, for fair wages, for tribal sovereignty. You know, we have to center the voices and leadership of women of color in all of those conversations, and we have to do this work in an intersectional way.
So maybe, as on other fronts, it's really an acknowledgement of the leadership that's been going on all this time in any event.
Absolutely.
Finally, it's not that journalists don't talk about abortion or don't talk about reproductive rights. They do. But I just wonder, how could media support and highlight the work that's being done? What would you like to see?
I do think one of the things we see oftentimes is a lot of assumptions, particularly around the beliefs and values of folks of color around these issues, right? So there's a myth that, for example, Latinos are Catholic and therefore they're anti-choice. And we have amazing research from the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health that says, in fact, they're with us on this issue. You just have to talk to them in a different way about it, right? So I think there's a lot of mythology around how Black and brown folks in particular feel about these issues. We know from our work on the Hyde Amendment that majorities of African Americans, Latinos, API communities actually support our work to ensure that every woman has access regardless of how much money she makes or where she lives. I think the media can help us bust some of this mythology. I think they can lift up voices from communities of color as their spokespeople on these issues, because they're going to help you both talk about, you know, reproductive rights and justice issues, but also make those linkages to Black Lives Matter, to the immigration rights fight. If we've learned nothing else from this cycle, is that, you know, as progressives, we really need to come from a values-based approach, and we really need to be doing movement work across progressive issues. And I think, at least in our movement, women of color leadership has been doing that for a long, long time. And so to me, having the media shine a spotlight on that leadership and how we lead is going to be really important.
We've been speaking with Destiny Lopez, co-director of All Above All. You can find them and their work online at allaboveall.org. Destiny Lopez, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much for having me.
There are pundits who still say we should wait and see what a Trump White House will do before expressing concerns. But that ignores how Trump's media-assisted prominence, the mainstreaming of his brand of brazen hatred, has encouraged and emboldened racist, sexist xenophobes around the country already. Donald Trump didn't invent hate crime, but he has put the relationship between legitimizing talk and violent action on a plate for media. So how will a press corps that still talks about race relations when they mean white supremacy deal with the particular brew now concocted? We're joined now by reporter A.C. Thompson, co-author of the book Torture Taxi, On the Trail of the CIA's Rendition Flights. He works now at ProPublica, joins us now by phone from the Bay Area. Welcome back to Counterspin, A.C. Thompson.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, we hear, of course, anecdotally or through social media about individual hate crimes, people who are targeted for harassment or for violence because of their perceived ethnicity or religion or gender. I think people might be a little surprised to learn that the official data collection on the problem is really not very good, is it?
It's abysmal. What's going on is that there's federal law that's been in place since about 1990 that says, hey, FBI, you have to go out to state and local cops and ask them what's going on with hate crimes in their jurisdictions. The problem is those local and state authorities are not compelled to compile decent statistics and give them to the FBI. So a lot of departments just don't participate. About 20% across the country don't participate at all. And then the others that do participate, I think a lot of them are lackadaisical. So in some of these states where we know there's a significant number of hate crimes, you're getting reports of 2, 3, 5 hate crimes a year. And people that follow this know that's simply not true.
Well, we saw James Comey come out and apologize for the lack of data. He seems to do that a lot. He was apologizing that the FBI didn't have good numbers on law enforcement killing of black people. And he's saying on this, too, yeah, we don't have so much to go on. Is it your sense that there is a lack of motivation, perhaps, to collect these things? Or is it really just that it's more work to do?
You know, there's several things going on here. One is that at the local level, a lot of local law enforcement officials don't necessarily know what they're dealing with, even today when they get a hate crime in their jurisdiction. So if you have a verbal assault that involves a racial epithet, that may get written up and reported as simply as a verbal assault and not as a hate crime in lots of different places. So that's one problem, is sort of training and the actual police work on the ground. The next problem is that there are no penalties for law enforcement agencies that don't submit accurate data to the FBI. And the FBI has not pushed them to submit accurate data. They have not been particularly forceful about getting decent data on a lot of fronts from state and local law enforcement. And so it just hasn't happened. There has been legislation that was introduced last congressional session saying, hey, this has got to change. Federal funding is going to be tied to departments accurately reporting hate crime information, and that legislation didn't go anywhere. So it'll be interesting to see if this comes up again in the next congressional session.
Well, of course, data by itself is not reporting. You have to talk to people or more importantly, listen to people. What is the project that ProPublica is involved with? What are the goals of what you're trying to do around collecting this information?
What we're doing is we're building a big coalition that involves civil rights groups, ethnic media, journalism students, and mainstream journalism outlets. And basically, what we're trying to do is create a complementary data set to the FBI's data. And what we're looking for are both things that would be defined under state laws or federal law as a hate crime, but also acts of intimidation and harassment that don't rise to that level. A lot of things that we're seeing on social media and Twitter, for example. And we are building this team to really try to understand, document, and react positively to this moment where we have a very direct linkage between political speech and crimes on the ground.
You know, you were talking about police departments not knowing maybe the definition or not categorizing things as hate crimes. And I think the same thing can go for journalists. You know, your motives are always going to be murky. You know, somebody is always going to have a friend who says they don't have a racist bone in their body. You know, I'm not trying to minimize the difficulty of getting a hold of this issue, you know, of talking about it. But of course, we have to talk about it. I mean, we have to.
Absolutely. I think what's unique about this moment in modern American history is that you have some very clear signs that what is happening, a lot of it relates very directly to the presidential election. So when you see graffiti that is a spin on the Trump campaign slogan, Make America Great Again, that says Make America White Again, and there's a big, huge swastika, Well, we know that this is a hate crime related to politics, to the current president-elect. When we see swastikas and the word Trump at a park in Brooklyn, we know what that's about. And a lot of the crimes that have occurred since the election that have been documented by groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center have quite clearly been connected to the political moment.
Well, you just mentioned Southern Poverty Law Center. When I was speaking with Heidi Byrick from that group, she told me that journalists tell her that they don't want to report on white supremacy or on racist acts because they have a sense that exposing it is legitimizing or almost glamorizing it. And that seems like an unwinning strategy. But I think it's partly because some journalists have kind of painted themselves into this corner of objectivity where they can't say things are bad or wrong. And I think it leads to a kind of undercoverage. I mean, I wonder, what are you looking for from journalists on this? Obviously to use the data, but what would you like to see reporters doing? You're a reporter who doesn't just count numbers, but actually goes out and talks to people. What sort of journalism do you think would be helpful in this moment?
You know, my belief is different than the people who say, oh, you know, we can't cover this because it's sort of legitimizing these kooks and giving them the attention they deserve. I think we have to report on every one of these incidents that we can verify and that we can get out there and interview people about. I think that's crucial. And I think what we need to do is do this journalism that in part is simply witnessing a very, very scary time in our lives and giving voice to the people who feel terrified. There are people in my community who feel terrified. We've had two very significant hate crimes in my community where I live. And those people, my neighbors, they need to be able to speak and say, hey, this is incredibly scary to us. It's tragic. It's very, very upsetting. And we need somebody to listen to us. And I think the goal of journalism in this moment is to generate some sort of reaction, whether that's a popular reaction that says, hey, we are not going to tolerate racism, ethnic hatred, and the rest in our community, or whether that's an official reaction that says, hey, we are going to take every one of these crimes absolutely seriously, and we're going to put people away if they are attacking one another based on religious beliefs or based on their race or ethnicity or gender orientation. I think the goal of journalism at this time is to provoke some sort of meaningful response from the public and from officialdom that says this is not something that will be tolerated.
We've been speaking with A.C. Thompson, reporter at ProPublica. Find them online at ProPublica.org. A.C. Thompson, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
You work and work for years and years, you're always on the go. You never take a minute off, too busy making dough. Someday you say you'll have your fun when you're a millionaire. Imagine all the fun you'll have in your old rocking chair.
Enjoy yourself. Later than you think. Enjoy yourself while you're still in the pink. The years go by as quickly as a wink. Enjoy yourself, enjoy yourself. It's later than you think.
What I have to tell is a very grim story indeed.
But it does require that we have a moratorium on any new coal-fired power plants, and over the next 25 to 30 years, we're going to have to phase out those that exist.
What if you knew that every time you flip on your light switch, a mountaintop in West Virginia just blows up?
Enjoy yourself, enjoy yourself. It's later than you.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Alex is about to die. And enter the year 2009.
Is it already too late to stop rampant climate change? An emailed blog posting asks, do we just enjoy the time we have left? Scientist James Lovelock thinks so. He wanted the subtitle of his new book, Vanishing Gaia, changed from Final Warning to Enjoy It While You Can. He tells famous interviewer David Frost in April 2009.
Enjoy it while you can.
Enjoy it while you can. And how old are you now?
I'll be 90 in July.
That's the opening for my Radio EcoShock show for June 26, 2009. We'll hear more clips and quotes from that program later on. We'll also talk with Ipek Genchku about the macro picture as billions of humans move into the cities in the next 50 years. Will they find a climate-friendly infrastructure to support them or carbon-intensive slums with no services? But first, we'll be joined by a medical doctor who asks a simple question. Should we wear clothes that endanger the lives of the people who make them? Watch out for viscose. Whether it's rayon, cellophane, or the common dish sponge, the chemicals used to make them may have driven workers crazy. It's just another journey into the underworld of the toxic society. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. Now and then, just one dedicated person can put the spotlight on a dangerous chemical. Every day, some of us wear or use products made with this toxic process. Few people know fabrics like rayon are made from forests boiled down by dangerous chemicals. So are cellophane and dish sponges. That person could be Dr. Paul David Blank. He's a real doctor and a professor of medicine at the University of California in San Francisco. The story and the warning come in Paul's new book, Fake Silk, The Lethal History of Viscose Rayon. Paul, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Glad to be here.
What put a practically unknown chemical like carbon disulfide in your sights?
Well, I'm an occupational medicine physician by training and also a medical toxicologist. So in that narrow field, people have heard of carbon disulfide, partly because it's such a powerful and fascinating toxic substance.
What is it really? I mean, is it a dust or a powder or what?
No, it's a liquid. It's a solvent. It's a very elegant little molecule, just one carbon and two sulfur elements linked together, and doesn't occur very much in nature except in the mouths of volcanoes and certain other rarefied situations. So essentially a synthetic chemical, but it has a long history. It goes back to the 18th century.
Well, let's talk about the fake silk in your book title. What is rayon and what makes it distinct from other industrial fibers we've heard about, like nylon or polyester?
Well, first of all, it's the granddaddy of all these fibers. It really predates all of the petroleum-based synthetics, including nylon, which came onto the scene in the late 1930s. But rayon was invented at the turn of the last century, just before 1900. And unlike the petroleum-based products, it's based on cellulose from plants, mostly wood pulp. That's all fine and good, but the key ingredient in making all that happen is this chemical called carbon disulfide.
I know that a lot of high-fashion designers, names we'd all know, use rayon. Paul Blank, what do they like about it, and why do consumers like it?
Well, consumers like rayon because it has silk-like properties, if it's pure, and also because it can be mixed with a lot of other fibers and give interesting blends. There's not a hazard to consumers by wearing it, so there's no risk there, and that's one of the reasons why people have not paid much attention to what happened to the workers who have made it for the last 120 years. In terms of fashion designers, it's people love to play around with new stuff. And there have been times also where shortages of other materials or political considerations promoted the use of rayon. So during the German occupation of France, when the Germans were quite interested in promoting the rayon industry, there was quite a push for French high design to use lots of rayon and rayon blends.
Well, let's talk about the known health impacts of carbon disulfide as used in the production of rayon and cellophane and other industrial products. Why don't we begin with the brain effects? I'm not really talking about mental health here, but just what does it actually do to the brain?
Well, the mechanism of its toxicity is still a matter of research debate. It's actually hard to tease out the mental health effects from other effects on the brain because, in fact, the mental derangement that it causes is one of its most stunning effects. And probably it interferes with various metabolic pathways and is able to cause these problems through that mechanism. So it was first noted very early on after it was first introduced industrially, not in rayon because rayon didn't exist, but in the rubber industry where it was used as part of an alternative vulcanization process, that the workers would go insane. And in fact, one of the rubber factories was famous for having iron bars on its second floor windows because so many workers had a tendency to jump out and kill themselves. Also was quite recognized to cause sexual proclivity in those exposed. That was later followed by impotence. So it had sort of a two-phase response.
What about heart problems? Is that why so many rayon workers died young?
Later on, and by later on, I mean it wasn't really until the 1960s that it became appreciated that long-time lower-level exposure, long-term lower-level exposure to carbon disulfide could, in fact, cause premature heart attack and premature stroke. That was difficult to study because it required some of the modern epidemiologic techniques that only came into the fore in the decades following World War II.
And as a sidelight, I found an astounding note in your book that the workers' compensation system in the United States doesn't seem to be actually written to protect the workers. It seems to protect the employers. No matter how egregious the damage or the death, the worker can't sue the employer. Why not?
Well, that's just standard in workers' compensation law. You cannot sue your employer. You're confined to stick to the compensation monetary scheme that's written into the law in the various states. If you're a consumer and made ill by a product or what's called a third-party relationship, then it's possible to sue, but not as an direct employee. So, in fact, for the asbestos industry, their Achilles heel has not been people who actually worked for the asbestos mining and milling companies. It was for secondary users who bought asbestos from a primary source.
Donald Trump has highlighted the flight of manufacturing jobs away from America and towards other countries in Mexico and Asia. Where were the major rayon factories of America and Europe located, and why do you think they closed down one after another?
First of all, they were the first to flee to other sites. So we're talking about the 1960s and 70s, but they were originally located in Pennsylvania and then fled to the southern United States, where there was less unionization of the workers. And that's been a classic in the textile industry generally. So later on, they were more concentrated in Virginia and Tennessee, North Carolina, and Georgia. And then these were mostly part of multinational corporations, which is another classic manifestation of this industry from even the years before World War I, they were cartels, and then between the wars, they were really interlocking directorates of various companies. The biggest American manufacturer was called the American Viscose Corporation, which was wholly owned by the British. It wasn't a publicly owned company until 1941, when the U.S. forced them to sell publicly as a quid pro quo for lend-lease, which the Americans were not going to agree to. At Courtauld, actually, their big cash cow was the U.S.-based operations that they had, although they had huge operations in Great Britain and the famous plant in Ontario that they had as well, which they were not forced to sell, obviously, because that was Canada. I don't think anybody wants to bring back these dangerous and polluting manufacturing sites to the United States, but there still are sites that manufacture with carbon disulfide. The largest cellophane factory in the world is in Kansas, and the various sponge manufacturing sites are in the United States as well as in Europe. There's also a very big industry of a sort of relative of cellophane, which is used to make skinless weenies and other rayon film packaged sausages. Then the rayon film is removed and you have a skinless sausage.
So what are the current allowable levels of carbon disulfide in the workplaces of the world, and are they good enough?
It depends on where you are. So the United States, the OSHA limit is about 20 times higher than what our own governmental scientists recommend is safe. So the value in the OSHA law is 20 parts per million. California, which can make its own stricter standards, at least right now it can, the limit is 1 part per million. And in fact, the U.S. limit is so lax, it's only met, I think, by the standard in India. Even China has a somewhat stricter standard. And China, India, and Indonesia are some of the biggest current manufacturers of rayon fiber.
Yeah, I think about half the rayon in the world comes from China now.
It may be close to that. Oh, fiber we're talking about, yes.
Yeah. You know, digging around, I was looking at the disposal of rayon, and it turns out to biodegrade better than cotton. But then Wikipedia pointed me to a paper published in 2014 saying, quote, "A recent ocean survey found that rayon contributed to 56.9% of the total fibers found in deep ocean areas, the rest being polyester, polyamides, acetate, and acrylic." So I'm wondering, how does so much rayon find its way into the ocean? Do you know?
I haven't a clue. I can say that the reason why it's biodegradable is it's regenerated cellulose. So the final product, the carbon disulfide, has all gone off into the air, often the air in which the workers are, but sometimes the ambient atmosphere. So that's why it's biodegradable, and that's why the rayon manufacturers and the viscose manufacturers market this material as being a green product, because it uses renewable cellulose rather than petroleum. It sort of ignores the carbon disulfide side of the equation, which is anything but a green product.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. Paul David Blank. We're talking about the lethal history of viscose rayon. As you say in your book, Paul, Fake Silk, that there has been a TV expose on the mental health impacts on workers at the Chinese electronics makers like Foxconn, but the risks appear to be greater for rayon workers. Why do you think this toxic production scandal, I'd call it, has evaded public scrutiny for so long?
Well, it hasn't evaded public scrutiny, in fact, or medical knowledge. It's just that there's a cyclical amnesia, I would describe it as. for this industry. You know, when even in the 19th century, when it was used in the rubber industry, very quickly there was medical recognition within just a handful of years of the new technology. And there were exposés periodically in more popular media as well. So it's not really through lack of knowledge. It's through a disequilibrium of economics and power, I would say.
Is there a threat to people living around those industrial plants that use carbon disulfide?
Well, clearly there have been examples of release into the ambient atmosphere that's been substantive enough to be associated with suspect effects. The most famous case was actually in Alabama, where one of the last U.S.-based rayon factories was, and where local residents noted that their prized horses were dying off, and it was found at autopsy to be suspect carbon disulfide related. They sued the plant and lost on a small technicality of how the nuisance law was written or the timing of some other piece, but not on truly substantive grounds.
In your book, you described the modern production facilities of the Lenzing Group in Austria, and the carbon disulfide is carefully enclosed and vented for worker protection, but vented to where, and can you somehow collect and store it, or what happens to it?
Well, they try to the extent that they can to recycle it into the process, right? I mean, the motivation for many of the controls has not been purely worker safety, but it's that it's cheaper in the long run if you don't send all this chemical up the smokestacks, because it leaves the product and you can reuse it.
So, Paul Blank, how does carbon disulfide reemerge from the pesticides story?
Well, it has a long history as a pesticide. It was the preferred, although useless, agent to try to stem the phylloxera epidemic of the 19th century that wiped out much of the grape industry in France, and they used many tons of this stuff. But it persisted as a fumigant in the grain industry until the 1970s, when the EPA in the United States finally nixed it. And it's still a byproduct of certain other pesticides. It was also like the preferred gopher exterminating agent, because it's heavier than air, it's very volatile. So you pour a bunch of it down a gopher hole and plug it up, and it kills all the gophers. So, in fact, there was a famous case report, not famous, but an impressive case report, let's say, in California in the late 19th century of two brothers who had 20 gallons of carbon disulfide that they were using to kill gophers. And it turned out there was a leak in the can, which they kept right near where they slept. And you know, they both went insane. One murdered somebody, and the other one just went crazy.
What's your impression of the health standards for carbon disulfide in China?
Well, on paper, they're better than the United States. What's actually going on in practice is almost anyone's guess. There are some very large foreign manufacturers there, but they have their own domestic companies as well.
What other countries are currently manufacturing rayon?
Well, let's talk about who's manufacturing viscose. So viscose in general, as I said, there's big manufacturing of cellophane in the United States and elsewhere outside of Asia. The sausage casing business is huge in the United States, in Europe, in Mexico, I believe there's a big facility. And the sponge business is big everywhere. It's really just the textiles that have concentrated in the last few decades in China. India is huge, and probably their conditions are worse than China, would be my impression. There certainly has been almost no study there. And Indonesia, not known for its biomedical research or protection of anyone.
So is there a way around this? Is there a totally safe way to make rayon or cellophane?
Well, first of all, there are some non-carbon disulfide processes. One of the newer ones that's been introduced that's actually a viscose process uses a different chemical, but it's really has very little human testing data on or animal testing data. So it's hard to know what the risk-benefit ratio might be, although it is, I grant you, it's hard to imagine a chemical worse than carbon disulfide. And then there are non-viscose rayon-producing methods. in the beginning of the introduction of these first synthetics. In fact, viscose was just one of several, but most of the other ones have died out. The one that hasn't is something called cupramonium production of rayon, which is a kind of niche specialty fake silk that is the preferred lining of bespoke suits, for example. If you buy a really high-end Italian designer suit, it's probably got a viscose lining, which is cupramonium, or sometimes referred to as Bemberg silk, because the Bemberg company in Germany used to be the big producers of this. Now it's produced in Japan.
So how do you hope this book will be used? What's it going to do?
Well, I think it's a cautionary tale. So it gives people a sense of what questions they should be wondering about with any new technology. This, after all, was as highfalutin and new as anything else in its day. But in terms of the textile industry also, I think consumers have to ask themselves, is it okay if what I wear is completely safe, but somebody had to risk their life making it? This is not just limited to viscose. We've seen an epidemic of silicosis in young persons sandblasting jeans to get a distressed look. And it's really parallel to the issue of, is it okay to get that cheap T-shirt that somebody made in a 10th floor sweatshop in Bangladesh that was about to collapse on them or be burned to death in the tradition of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire.
We have to own our clothes then.
Yes, and I think there is some movement, consumer movement, to demand verification that the methods of production for what they buy are inspected and meet some kind of minimal international standards.
Well, as we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to add, Paul?
Well, I think that it's just important to always remember that the tale that I tell is something that happened to real people. These were real lives that were damaged or lost, and we need to remember these people. It's important. Just even that act is important, to honor them.
I've just read the new book, Fake Silk, The Lethal History of Viscose Rayon. The author and our guest is M.D. Paul David Blank. Paul does clinical studies and research, plus he's the chair of occupational and environmental medicine at the University of California in San Francisco. You can find links to this book and the basic deadly chemistry of boiling down wood in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Dr. Paul Blank, thank you for sharing your time and for this warning.
Oh, I'm very happy to have done it.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Toxins and workers' rights are not the only problem with viscose rayon fabric. Every year, between 70 and 120 million trees are cut down to make rayon, viscose, motile, and other trademark textiles. Ancient forests are logged, rare ecosystems leveled, forest-dependent communities affected, and the forest homes of threatened and endangered species such as orangutans, tigers, elephants, bears, and wolves are hauled off to make T-shirts and suit jacket linings. Fortunately, efforts are underway to reverse this trend. In 2013, the environmental group Canopy launched a campaign to change the course of the fashion industry. Now, several of the world's largest clothing brands and iconic designers have committed to end all fiber sourcing from the world's ancient and endangered forests in 2017. H&M, Zara Inditex, Stella McCartney, Marks & Spencer, Levi Strauss, and other global retailers and designers have signed on to Canopy's style. Over 85 brands and several of the world's largest viscose producers are on board, but there's more work to be done. Learn more at canopyplanet.org.
Do we still get to avoid more warming here?
There is nothing that we can do to stop a climate change in its tracks. There's a tremendous amount of momentum built into the climate system. We are not yet experiencing the full consequences of the heat-trapping gases we've already added to the atmosphere because of time lags in the way the global climate system responds. So we will see some continuing increase in global surface temperature and regional increases in surface temperatures no matter what we do. But we have a big opportunity to minimize the amount of change we will experience. The aim that most scientists who study this matter have agreed is one that is still within reach and is highly desirable would be to stabilize the concentration of heat-trapping gases in the atmosphere at a level that would limit the global average surface temperature increase to about 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit above the pre-industrial level. Now, if we do everything right, I think we could achieve that.
Well, my view is our duty is to survive. You see, it's not going to be totally fatal. There'll be quite a lot of us survive. And our descendants have got to inherit a worthwhile place. Like these islands, for example, are going to be horribly overcrowded. So are lots of other places in the world. We don't want it to turn into some sort of shackville. We want it them to have sort of decent cities with proper infrastructures. And that's enough of a job to keep us busy. I don't think we should be wasting time and energy trying to stop it with rather useless means. They talk of a tipping point, that we go so far and then there's catastrophe. But it implies that you can go back if you don't reach the tipping point. I don't think we can.
That was Sir James Lovelock with interviewer David Frost on April 10th, 2009. Our next clip comes from a program called The Hour on CBC in Canada with host George Strombolopoulos.
Is it certain parts of the globe that are going to be harder hit than others?
Very much so, and Canada is unusually favoured. This is the sort of place, when it happened before, 55 million years ago, life not only survived, but things moved here to get away from the heat. Mm-hmm. And that's likely to happen again. But this time it'll be people moving. And I think the main problem for Canada will be how to handle the influx of people from outside the world and when to be able to say, no, we've got enough now. If we take any more, we can't feed you. The best way to look at it is, I think of yourself as somebody walking in a forest somewhere, and you pick up a gun, and you accidentally pull the trigger and it goes off and does some damage. You didn't intend to do that. You kind of pulled the trigger by accident, and that's what we've done. We pulled a trigger on the system, and the system is now moving into another state.
So let's say, like, in centuries from now, this could have happened anyway, but we've just kick-started the process.
Exactly.
Wow. So that means, then, that we should have a really good time, shouldn't we?
Well, it won't be all bad. No. There'll be some exciting moments, I think.
That's another selection of Early Madness from my 2009 Radio EcoShock show, Enjoy Yourself, It's Later Than You Think. Of course, now 7 years after, it's even later than that.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. There are still the optimists who work to persuade world governments to start aiming for a sustainable world. Let's hear what they think. More than a few scientists on Radio EcoShock tell us our present economy threatens perhaps to kill us and take out many other species in the sixth great mass extinction. Surely, we all have an interest in a new climate economy. And that's a huge global task. I've come across a report that seems written to me in a bland code for top government and corporate planners, but there are gems buried in this work titled The Sustainable Infrastructure Imperative. It's the 2016 report from something called the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate. Their website is newclimateeconomy.net. To help us sort out who that is and what this report can tell us, as citizens of this planet, I've called on Ipek Genshu. She's the research and engagement manager at the New Climate Economy. Ipek has degrees in politics and economy from the London School of Economics. You may also have heard about her as a campaigner for the charity Oxfam and for climate and food justice. From Washington, D.C., Ipek Genshu, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, it's great to be here.
To be honest, I'm a little afraid of this interview. Can we hope to translate this 2016 report into something that means something in the lives of our listeners?
I think we definitely can, because infrastructure is something that most of us live with every day, and I'm here to try to explain why I think it really touches all of us. It's important for all of us.
Okay, well, can you explain what the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate is and how it was formed?
Sure. So the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate was commissioned by 7 countries in 2013. Those are UK, Norway, and Sweden, our 3 funding countries. And we also have Ethiopia, Korea, Indonesia, and Colombia, developing countries. And they got together and said, we need to do some really strong analysis to show whether we can have economic growth and reduce the effects of climate change at the same time. Now, there was a lot of worry at the time by countries implementing renewable systems who thought this is hurting our economy, it's too costly, and we just cannot do it because for the sake of our citizens, we have to prioritize a strong economy for them. So the Commission got together and with the help of 8 research institutes, but also a number of international organizations, experts in this field, we put together analysis in our flagship report in 2014, which showed from across the world examples of how sustainable growth, low carbon growth, can be compatible with strong economic growth. And we followed up our work in the guidance of the Commission and an economic advisory panel over the past few years to dig a little bit more into detail in specific areas and also in different countries to show how this can be made possible.
And this report is about infrastructure. Can you give us examples of what that is?
Sure. As I mentioned, infrastructure is something we live with in our lives every day. It's the buildings that we live and we work in, our homes. It's the transport systems. It's the roads that we drive on and the train lines we take into work. It's also the source of our power. So it's the coal plants or solar panels. Whatever source of power you use is what provides electricity for us and keeps us going. Our water systems, our sewage systems, that's all infrastructure. We look at infrastructure and we look at evidence across 3 sectors in our report. Those are cities, energy, and also land use. So we importantly say that land use is also a type of infrastructure. So irrigation systems, landscaping, all of these things are things that we impose on the existing landscape. And we see it as infrastructure.
How does the Global Commission define the difference between sustainable and unsustainable infrastructure?
So the definition isn't always very clear, but we go with 3 broad principles. One is that it has to be environmentally sustainable. So we are using the world's limited resources. We have to do it in a way that provides for future generations. The second component of environmental sustainability is, of course, climate change. So we have to make sure that we're limiting the effects of climate change by reducing greenhouse gas emissions, so sustainable infrastructure is also low carbon. The second component for us is it has to be economically sustainable, so it doesn't burden governments with debt for generations to come. And finally, it has to serve all. It has to be socially sustainable, not just the select few who can afford certain types of life, but it has to enable everybody access to work opportunities and to be connected to their families and live in healthy, happy environments.
This report contains a roadmap which identifies the need to stop subsidies of fossil fuels by taxpayers. Who are some of the countries who offer those subsidies, and how big is the total?
It's a lot of countries, a lot of developed countries, and also developing countries. Worldwide, there are about $500 billion of subsidies available, offered by governments to both the production and the consumption of subsidies. For example, Russia offers about $23 billion a year. In the U.S., the value is about $20 billion, actually just over $20 billion a year. This is federal subsidies as well as subsidies in fossil fuel-producing states. And the difficult thing about subsidies is that they often benefit the middle class, because they're making it cheaper to drive cars, they're making it cheaper to use electricity when a lot of the poorer segments of the population don't get most of the benefits. By comparison, quickly, to also put in perspective, renewables only get around $120 billion per year as subsidies. So, there's really a lot of money going into this to continue our high carbon-based way of development, and there are also good opportunities for reforming these subsidies, which has been happening in many countries, including in Indonesia, in Canada, and the U.S. and France as well. They are starting to restrict them, which is good.
Is the clean infrastructure we're looking for a responsibility that governments direct, or is the private sector involved?
it's obviously the public sector's responsibility because they owe it to their citizens to grow the countries in a good way and providing services to people. But for the private sector, actually, it's a great opportunity. It's a great financial opportunity because a lot of money goes into building the buildings and the transport systems, but then their use generates a lot of income for them. So it's an opportunity for both. In developed countries, about 60% of infrastructure is built using private funds. In developing countries, this is the other way around. So 60% comes from the government. We actually need to increase private financing towards infrastructure because we'll be making around $90 trillion of infrastructure investment across the world over the next 15 years. And a lot of this money will have to come from private and institutional investors.
And the report calls us to transform the financial architecture. Can you give us specific examples of what is needed?
Sure. So this sounds a bit jargony, but the main point is our financial systems and processes are based on a previous model of development, which was quite short-termist. It was based on fossil fuels. It was based on building roads and getting people to drive cars. So all the risks and opportunities are around providing for those. What we now need to do is to make sure the financial system works for renewable technologies, for green investment, for sustainable investment needs. And so the difference will be that there are more upfront costs, but in the longer term, there'll be lower operating costs. So, for example, if we take the comparison of a coal plant versus solar panels, it is probably less costly to build a coal plant than the same amount of energy coming from solar panels. But once you build the coal plant, you have to keep supplying it with coal, whereas the sunshine is free. So the financial system has to take this into account and lower the risks of the upfront capital costs so that in the long run, the costs level out and investors are actually interested to invest in these technologies.
To hear the politicians talk, governments are investing heavily to help develop a survivable, low-carbon future. But we learned from this report that, quote, today's public research and development and deployment of energy as a share of GDP is half what it was in the 1980s, end quote. How is that possible, given the dangers we face from climate change and the challenges of feeding a growing population?
Yes, I mean, you're right, but this figure is very worrying. We do have to invest more in sustainable technologies and research and development. I think part of the reason might be that there's a lot more private funding going into these areas, which is great, but we do need government funding to guide us in the right direction. Government funding is a big signal of the way things have to develop. And if they are signaling that these low-carbon technologies are a priority, that will also catalyze private funding towards them. The other thing that the governments need to help us fund is the deployment of existing technologies. We have a lot of technologies already available to us. The costs are coming down, and it's just a question of making sure that they get implemented in different businesses, in different areas, in schools, in buildings. A lot of these technologies, energy efficiency technologies, can be implemented, but we need to make sure that the government is supporting this.
Now, the 2016 report from the Global Commission begins by saying the existing stock and use of infrastructure is associated with more than 60% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. That's a shocking number. And where does that 60% number come from?
That comes from some analysis we did earlier on in our research in the first year, which basically says that all the processes that go into construction, into cement and steel production, and the emissions that come from their use, from power plants, from the use of motor cars, all of these add up to 60% of all our global emissions. So this is a very significant percentage. And of course, we have to keep building, but there are ways of getting this number down.
This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking with Ipek Genchsu, and we're talking about a new report from a global commission and the need for a new climate economy. The very first sentence of the executive summary raises questions for me. It says, quote, investing in sustainable infrastructure is key to tackling three simultaneous challenges, reigniting global growth, delivering on sustainable development goals and reducing climate risk. Well, the last two are fine, but I realize the mantra for all politicians is growth, growth, growth. But our listeners question whether growth is possible in a world constrained by the limits of nature and the things we've been talking about, resources and atmosphere. So if we really want to save the species and the future climate, shouldn't we be talking about planned degrowth instead?
Well, in an ideal world, maybe you could say yes. But to be honest, this is not a realistic approach, I think. There are two issues with it. One is that it's not the way our world works. As you say, our politicians and high-level decision-makers, business leaders, have to look into a portfolio that is going somewhere, that is growing. So while I think there is a role for scientists and NGOs to keep pushing for minimizing this relentless growth, we do need a bit more of a realistic outlook on this. Secondly, we need to provide for the people in low-income countries and middle-income countries that still lack access to basic services and goods. They need access to healthcare, transport, education, and clean and safe housing. So we do need to grow their economies and their infrastructure systems. It's just a question of balancing between what some of us in the developing world consume on a daily basis and what others have to. So I can give you an analogy. If you had a wardrobe full of clothes, as most of us do in some parts of the world, you don't need any more. In fact, you could be recycling some of them. You could be giving them away. You could definitely reduce your amount of consumption. And this is what a lot of approaches of resource efficiency, such as circular economy approaches, help us do. On the other hand, as I said, many people do need access to things. If they have a wardrobe with nothing in there, they do need to provide for themselves. So we will have growth, but hopefully it will be a changing way of growth.
Well, I know you worked on climate justice issues, IPEC, and what is at stake for the women of this world?
Well, this is a really crucial point, and I probably cannot do justice to it as part of this interview. There are so many interlinking advantages and disadvantages for women in this sphere. But in short, we could say that in developing countries, many of the burdens of lack of infrastructure and services fall on women. So they are the ones who spend a considerable part of their day fetching water, providing food for the family. They're the ones who are suffering from health risks, and they're the ones who have to give up their education as a first member of the family. So making sure that the sustainable infrastructure is something that governments can provide will free up their time and their resources and empower them to be able to access the workforce and hopefully reach a level of equality with other parts of the population.
I'd like to address a question that came up in a short online video about this report at New Climate Economy. And it says, in the next 15 or 20 years, we're going to build around 1.5 times the infrastructure that already exists today. That frightens me because we're going to impinge on the world even more than we already do. Who says that's going to happen and where is it going to happen?
Well, so this is on an analysis that one of our partners, Brookings Institution, conducted for us. And it shows that the amount of infrastructure in place is pretty much the same as the amount that is going to be built. Now, this is based on some calculations which are looking at population growth trends and urbanization trends. By 2050, for example, we expect 70% of the world's population to live in cities. At the moment, about 30 to 40% of them do so. So it's going to be a huge increase. In India, about 400 million people will move to cities in the next 15 to 20 years. In China, about 300. In Nigeria, about 200. You know, this is a huge influx of people from rural areas into cities, and they will be requiring the services, the infrastructure that, again, most of us enjoy in more developed countries. And we will have to build a large amount of infrastructure to be able to provide for them, which is why exactly this point about sustainability is key, because the way in which we make these infrastructure decisions in the next 3 to 5 years will determine the future of our planet for decades to come.
That is an awe-inspiring number of refugees, or mass migration, let's call it, not to mention the refugees that we're expecting. So it's a huge change in the world population and where they live. Right about now, there are big projects, proposals sitting on the desks of legislators, prime ministers, and presidents awaiting approval. Some are pipelines, some are green mass transit. Most of them will produce still more greenhouse gases through cement and transport and mining and all that. Couldn't we just stop building infrastructure and help save the climate that way?
Well, as I said before, we could do it, but it's unrealistic. And also, it's not morally right. You know, there are a lot of people in the world who deserve access to services and healthcare and education. And there are about 1.7 billion people who have no electricity access. Can you imagine your everyday life without electricity? There are about 3 billion people who don't have clean cooking facilities. They're having to do makeshift solutions. And so we cannot stop building infrastructure, but we can be clever about the way we build it. We build it in ways that are sustainable, that provide for those people, and we don't build unnecessary things. We don't consume in unnecessary ways. In the developing world, we build smarter transport systems where many people can share transport or they can use public transport and train lines instead of building roads, which encourage individualized car use.
The new Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, just announced the National Climate Plan will include a price on carbon. Is that happening in many countries yet, and why does it matter?
Yes, so it's quite encouraging that about 40 countries and 20 subnationals are introducing carbon pricing. And it's important because carbon pricing basically means taking into account what it costs to continue to fund fossil fuels and a high carbon-based development model. So if you price carbon, that is, first of all, sending a signal to people saying, you know, we think this is costly to our country, the way we develop, so we should limit it. It's a good tool to be able to make decisions and allocations. If you take into account a cost of carbon, you can say this project, this renewable project, is less costly because it doesn't emit carbon emissions. And finally, it can raise financing. At the moment, as we discussed, a lot of government subsidies are going towards fossil fuel projects. And if you were to decrease that amount, that money could be used for much more useful areas, such as providing services and education to people. And just to finish up on that point, it's not just governments. About 1,200 companies across the world have introduced or are planning to in the next couple of years an internal carbon price. That means they're making their company decisions, taking into account the cost of emissions, which is very encouraging.
We've heard some stories about developing countries skipping the stage of fossil fuel development, going straight for greener technology. Is that just hype or is it happening?
It is happening. One of our commissioning countries, Korea, for example, has been able to do that really well and providing, as I mentioned, these connected transport systems for people and efficient housing. So it is possible, and it's actually posing really good opportunities for us in the developing world and low-income countries. For example, in Africa, where people don't even have internet access or landlines, they're able to buy mobile phones, and through that, they're able to pay in installments for solar lighting systems. This is exactly what we call leapfrogging. It's, you know, skipping past some of the business's usual ways of development that the high-income countries have experienced. And instead, it's going straight through to cleaner, more sustainable ways, which are also better for countries' economies and for people's pockets.
Ipek Genshu, in addition to your qualifications in politics and economics, you have an activist background. Can you get some things done where you are now?
Yes. So I think activism is a very important part of this puzzle. And in fact, the important Paris Climate Agreement that was signed in December last year was the result of the collaboration between activists, NGOs, civil society, and businesses and government. So I think there's a really important role for all the different pieces of the puzzle to work together. In my role now, I'm much more working with decision makers in government, in ministries, and we really have to work around their constraints about, as we mentioned earlier, about economic growth and about having to meet financial targets. So I feel like in this role and as part of the new climate economy team, we're able to do that because we understand how they think, we understand the constraints they have, and we tried to come up with solutions that work for them.
You know, after going through the 2016 report, I had the urge to rewrite the whole thing for the common person. We're the ones at the end of the new pipelines or switching on solar-powered lights instead. We buy the gas or electric-powered cars. Don't we need a vision of sustainable infrastructure that translates into the lives of voters of the public?
Absolutely. Our mission in the new climate economy team is to influence high-level decision-makers, ministers and CEOs, etc. But there is a great need for the general public to make these arguments and, in fact, to switch their way of life, especially those of us in richer countries. We do have to make sure we make our everyday decisions in a way that is sustainable. And this is now emerging, especially amongst the millennials and the younger generation, through car sharing systems. You know, not everyone believes that you need to have your own car anymore because there are great apps that you can use on your mobile device which allow you to share with friends. There's a great recycling, circular economy practices where people are able to borrow from each other and recycle their furniture, their clothes, their books. These kind of things are already emerging, and we just need to keep doing it. We just need to encourage it, and we need to make it cool to live our lives in this way.
And at the end of the online video, Felipe Calderon says, it is time for us all to realize that sustainable infrastructure is not just one potential pathway among many, but the only growth path for our future. Could you tell us why this is true?
Well, one side of the story is the catastrophic predictions that some scientists are making. If we were to continue in the path that we're on and the world's temperature, average temperature, increased beyond 3, 4, 5 degrees. That would become a completely inhabitable world with much more extreme weather events, with floods and hurricanes that would destroy many, many parts of the world. So we definitely don't want to go down that path, and we definitely don't want to take that risk. But on the other hand, there are some more important things that we're experiencing now every day, such as high levels of air pollution. You know, using the model of growth that we've used with fossil fuels, with cars, we are emitting so much carbon dioxide in the air, as well as other harmful gases, that it's really damaging our lives, it's damaging our lungs and our health. So this is the only growth story for the future, because it's the only one that will limit the risks for the planet, that will limit the health risks for us, and finally provide a sustainable and inclusive way of growth for the developing countries and the developing population.
Well, we're going to have to wrap it up there. We have been diving for diamonds in a very big picture report from the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate. Our guide from the commission is the activist and expert Ipek Genchsu. Thank you for your help, Ipek.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
For Radio EcoShock, I'm Alex Smith. You can find this new report at newclimateeconomy.net, and I'll put links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info.
Tom Petty speaks about the environment at rockearth.com.
I've always put a lot of stock in the human being, you know, maybe more than I should. But I put a lot of stock in humans. I know some humans that are pretty doggone great and pretty doggone powerful. So being a cautious optimist, I tend to trust that the humans will somehow save us from total annihilation. But as far as the environment goes, I don't know if it's getting better or worse, you know. And at least there's an awareness that it's a bad thing to tear it up, which we didn't have, you know, not so many years ago. But I think it's got a long way to go. I think we're just going to really have to count on people. And it's a corny thing to say today, and it's an almost laughable thought, because they've just torn hell out of everything they've ever got their hands on. But I think there's something in them that could also do something really great.
Well, I've worn back down. No, I've worn back down. You could stand me up at the gates of hell, but I've worn back down. I'm gonna stand my ground. I won't be turned around. And I'll keep this world from dragging me down. Gonna stand my ground. And I won't back down.
We'll head on out with more clips from my 2009 Radio EcoShock show. I'll put links to the whole program in my show blog at ecoshock.org. And please, don't forget, you can download all 10 years of Radio EcoShock shows for free. Scan around, pick out the ones that look interesting, courtesy of Radio EcoShock listeners. There's a wealth of great science, authors, and activists just waiting with their voices still worth hearing. Feel free to load up your phone, iPad, or whatever with those MP3 files to listen and to learn. The world is changing so fast, we all have to keep educating ourselves. I'm Alex Smith, saying thank you for listening and caring about your world.
James Lovelock is 90, famous and wealthy and ready to push off. He can be optimistic about a giant cull of humanity, mass death within the lifetimes of our descendants or sooner. Oh, great. So let's just give up and enjoy ourselves with another cruise ship holiday? No thanks. I've got a much better scientist role model for you and for me.
We did not realize until recently that previous warm periods, the previous so-called interglacial periods, some of which were warmer than the present one, were not very much warmer. At most, 1 degree warmer than the present period. On the other hand, there were times, if we go back 3 million years ago, when the Earth was about 3 degrees warmer, but it was a different planet. There was no sea ice in the Arctic, and sea level was at least 15 meters higher, probably about 25 meters higher. That's 80 feet. I mean, that's a huge climate change. It's something that we really would have a very hard time dealing with because we've set up all of our infrastructure with the coastlines where they are now. And also, a warming that large would have a huge impact on many species. It would drive many high-latitude and high-altitude species to extinction. So we really cannot afford, we really don't want to have a climate change of anything like that magnitude.
It's James Hansen, the head of NASA, Goddard Space Institute for Space Studies in New York City, and a professor at Columbia University. Way back in 1988, he warned the U.S. government that climate change could damage our world.
What did you say to the Congress 20 years ago, and how was it received?
Well, I said that 1988 was likely to be the warmest year in the history of instrumental measurements. And I said that the Earth had entered a period of long-term warming. I could say with 99% confidence that it would continue to get warmer. And that this was almost certainly due to human-made greenhouse gases, and that this affected the probability of extreme events like heat waves and droughts. And since then, the events have proven those statements to be basically correct.
That was James Hansen speaking with the unbeatable Diane Reams of NPR in a 20-year retrospective.
Hansen on Democracy Now!
NASA's top climate scientist, James Hansen, warned on Monday the world has long passed the dangerous level for greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and that the Earth is nearing a tipping point. Hansen said, quote, "We're toast if we don't get on a very different path. This is the last chance." He also called for the government to block the construction of new coal-fired plants. During an interview on NPR, Hansen called for the chief executives of oil companies to be tried for their role in spreading disinformation on climate change.
The groups, the American Geophysical Union, the American Meteorological Society, the National Academy of Sciences, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is a United Nations international organization, all of these large panels of scientists have made very clear statements about the reality of global warming and its cause. So the of course, in the hundreds of thousands of scientists in the world, you can find a number of them which will say anything, and that gets a lot of attention because the fossil fuel industry has taken the position that it will give prominence to those contrarians. And that's one of the big problems we have, because now the public does not know that there's such a large consensus among the scientific community, because it sounds like there's a debate, and there's really no real scientific debate. global warming enhances both extremes of the hydrologic cycle. And that means not only heat waves and droughts and forest fires, which go with the higher temperatures at times and places where it's dry, but also at the other extreme of the water cycle, when the atmosphere is warmer, it holds more water vapor. And therefore, when you get rain, you get heavier rains and larger floods.
Radio EcoShock.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
This is Jeff Blankford with Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way each month. And the second and fourth Wednesdays, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. If we don't wake up to the news of yet another horrible domestic cabinet appointment on the part of President-elect Donald Trump, we can consider ourselves and the country lucky. Today wasn't such a day. Even Saturday Night Live, in an attempt at satire, would have trouble surpassing Trump's choice of ExxonMobil's Rex Tillerson for Secretary of State, Rick Perry for Energy Secretary, Scott Pruitt for head of the Environmental Protection Agency, Tom Price for Health and Human Services, Ben Carson for Housing and Urban Development, Betsy DeVos for Education, Jeff Sessions for Attorney General, Steve Mnuchin as Treasury Secretary, Mike Pompeo as head of the CIA, and last but not least, Steve Bannon from Breitbart as Trump's strategic advisor. Bannon's appointment, unlike the others, will not be subject to Senate confirmation. I will assume that by now you have heard or are aware of the relevant details of each of these creatures and don't need any more convincing from me that considered individually or collectively their approval by the Senate will be a disaster for the country. The same can be said for the three generals, Mattis, Kelly, and Flynn, chosen by Trump to head the War Department, Homeland Security, and be his national security advisor. But that's not what Washington and the media, with much of what passes for alternative, it is in lockstep with the mainstream, is focused on at the moment. In a report, is a report by the CIA that accuses the Russians of having interfered in the American presidential elections by having hacked into the emails of the Democratic National Committee, as well as key Hillary Clinton staff members, most notably John Podesta, and turning the information over to WikiLeaks, which, according to the CIA, then made it public. The intent of all this, we are told, was not only to destabilize our democratic processes, as if both political parties hadn't already done that, but to make sure that Donald Trump would become our 45th president. Trump, as to be expected, has dismissed the allegations as, quote, sour grapes on the part of Hillary Clinton's supporters. Forgotten in all this, it seems, is what the first set of leaked emails revealed, that it was not Russia, but the Democratic National Committee working on behalf of Clinton that was interfering with our elections by doing what it could do to sabotage the chances of Senator Bernie Sanders in the party's primaries. The evidence of this contained in the leaked emails was so substantial that DNC Chair Florida Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz and three of her staff members were forced to resign. Instead of distancing herself from her actions, Clinton made Wasserman Schultz the honorary chair of a presidential campaign. All this shouldn't be noted with the importance it deserves, considering that Sanders defeated Clinton in two key Midwestern states, Michigan and Wisconsin, that she would later lose to Trump. What Trump and Sanders had in common was that both were openly campaigning against the political establishment, against the candidates their respective parties had anointed, and that, as exit polls revealed, was a key factor in Trump's eventual victory. American voters, as we have seen, were not alone in rejecting their country's entrenched political establishment. The vote by the British to leave the European Union in June, which came to be known as Brexit, caught politicians on both sides of the English Channel as well as across the Atlantic by surprise, even those who had supported it. The Brexit vote was quickly adopted by Trump as a harbinger for November, as it was for politicians on Europe's far right who had also made immigrant bashing the center of their campaigns. Trump just happened to be in Scotland at the time of the vote, from where he told CNN, quote, "Come November, the American people will have the chance to redeclare their independence. Americans will have a chance to vote for trade, immigration, and foreign policies that put our citizens first," he said. "They will have the chance to reject today's rule by the global elite and to embrace real change that delivers a government of, by, and for the people," end quote. Judging from Trump's appointment thus far, they are not likely to get it. How his victory has impacted Europe and its political future, particularly in France, is what I will be exploring later in the program with Paris-based journalist Diana Johnstone. Johnstone has just returned from Italy, where Prime Minister Matteo Renzi's attempt to implement constitutional reforms in a national election 2 Sundays ago were so resoundingly defeated that he was obliged to resign. I last spoke with Johnstone in November a year ago about her then-just-published book, Queen of Chaos, A History of Hillary Clinton's Critical Role in Expanding the U.S. Empire. That'll be at 20 minutes past the hour, so stay tuned for that. Meanwhile, let's go back for a moment to the CIA's allegations that Russia had hacked the Democratic National Committee and John Podesta's emails to benefit Trump, because while we were told they also hacked the emails of the Republican National Committee, they hadn't made them public. As the Republican National Committee denies that its emails were hacked seems to have been ignored by the media, as was the fact that the agency offered no specific proof that the Russians were involved in the case of the DNC or John Podesta. Why Putin would have wanted Clinton defeated is obvious. She and her neocon cohorts have been pushing for a confrontation with Moscow and the expansion of NATO to Russia's borders since her former press spokesperson, Victoria Nuland, later appointed by Obama as Deputy Secretary of State for Europe, orchestrated the now-forgotten coup that overthrew the president of Ukraine in 2014 and led Russia to annex Crimea, which in Sebastopol on the Black Sea provided its only warm water port. Contrary to what has been reported over and over in the media, Russia did not invade Crimea, since according to an agreement with previous Ukraine governments, it had 25,000 troops already stationed there with an option signed in 2010 to keep them there until 2042. Sebastopol had, in fact, been a Russian port since 1783, and Crimea was still considered part of Russia until the Ukrainian-born Prime Minister Nikita Khrushchev signed it over to Ukraine in 1954. Since Ukraine was then part of the Soviet Union, the move had little significance at the time, but that history is no less important today, as the warmongers in Washington, who are counting on a Clinton victory, are clearly pressing ahead with their plans for a confrontation with Russia and using the allegation of hacked emails as a device to do so. That their moves are receiving support from a number of liberal and self-described progressive media outlets is what is most upsetting. Would they have preferred that the public not know what the Democratic Party establishment had done to defuse the Bernie Sanders campaign? Apparently so. WikiLeaks' Julian Assange, speaking from his enforced stay at London's Ecuadorian embassy, has denied any Russian involvement, which is not surprising, but he had his own motivation to see Clinton defeated, since she is reported to have suggested he be targeted with a drone strike at a White House meeting. While her defenders have said she made the suggestion in jest, Clinton is not known for her humor, aside from having had a good laugh after watching the video of Muammar Gaddafi's disemboweling. You can still see it on YouTube. "We came, we saw, he died," she exclaimed, and then exploded in hysterical laughter. A senior official cited by the Washington Post conceded that intelligence agencies did not have specific proof that the Kremlin was, quote, directing the hackers, who is said to be one step removed from the Russian government. Craig Murray, the former UK ambassador to Uzbekistan, who is a close associate of Assange, called the CIA claims bull bleep
adding that they are absolutely making it up. I know who leaked them, Murray said. I've met the person who leaked them, and they are certainly not Russian, and it's an insider. It's a leak, not a hack. The two are different things. If what the CIA are saying is true, said Murray, and the CIA statement refers to people who are known to be linked to the Russian state, they would have arrested someone if it was someone inside the United States. America has not only been shy about arresting whistleblowers and has not been shy about extraditing hackers. Or trying to. They plainly have no knowledge whatsoever, said the former British ambassador, Craig Murray. At this point, I must say a word about NPR, which provides much of our excellent national programming. As a listener to its news reports over the past 3.5 decades, it has become clear that it has been assigned a critical role to play in persuading, for better or worse, what can be described as U.S. intelligentsia to support U.S. foreign policy. It does so uncritically, the only exceptions being when a guest, either a member of Congress or an expert from a Washington think tank, who believes that the White House policy in certain instances, such as Syria, is not aggressive enough. In other words, it becomes national propaganda radio and has been performing in that role going back to the U.S. intervention in Central America when it parroted the Reagan administration line, through the Carter then Reagan intervention in Afghanistan in 1979, through the current wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, the conflicts in Libya and Syria, the coup in Ukraine, and since then repeating the allegations of Russian invasions, Russian aggression, and Russian threats against the Baltic states, all of which are arguably non-existent. At no point will you hear from any NPR commentator or guest that the majority of our European allies, with Britain being the exception, are opposed to the current U.S. sanctions on Russia, and, as was the case during the Cold War with the old Soviet Union that was never reported in the U.S., they don't consider Russia a threat. They don't support Russia, but they don't consider it a threat. That's why the Obama administration and the hawks in NATO have had to browbeat the leading members of the organization to spend at least 2% of their national budget on weaponry, some of which, of course, will be purchased in the United States. Unlike the U.S., which prioritizes military spending, our European allies, despite all their other problems, put the welfare of their citizens first. Even the New York Times manages to mention Europe's differences with Washington from time to time, usually in the middle or the end of an article, but you're not likely to hear it on NPR. Yesterday on Morning Edition, for example, you were treated to a good example of how it works, with former CIA chief Michael Hayden being asked for his opinion of Russia's hacking and Donald Trump's dismissal of the allegations in the first hour and Senator John McCain on the same subject in the second hour. An editorial credited to the paper's entire editorial board in Monday's New York Times, headlined "Russia's Hand in America's Election," made it clear why the Russians would prefer a Trump victory by citing Clinton's bellicose position during the presidential campaign. Hillary Clinton, it wrote, the Democratic nominee, made it clear her administration redoubled efforts to punish and isolate Moscow for war crimes in Syria's civil war and its aggression toward Ukraine and other neighbors. "I've stood up to Russia," Ms. Clinton said during a debate in the fall. "I've taken Putin on, and I would do that as president," end quote. What the Times didn't mention is that she had compared him to Hitler following Russia's annexation of Crimea, and that upon taking office, she planned to implement a no-fly zone over Syria, despite warnings from military officials that it would risk a war with Russia. It didn't mention the role that Clinton, as Secretary of State, had played in supporting the creation of the Islamic State in Syria that had been revealed earlier by WikiLeaks and confirmed by Trump's chosen National Security Advisor, General Michael Flynn, when he was head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, which I cited on an earlier program. And, of course, it didn't mention this country's unmatched record of interfering in other countries' elections and overthrowing democratically elected governments, beginning with that of post-war Italy, to make sure that the Italian Communist Party that led the anti-Nazi resistance would not come to power through fair elections, that prevented the unification of Vietnam following its defeat of the French colonialists, which Washington had supported. Even if the Russians did, in fact, do the hacking, as the CIA and Moscow's critical edge, it would amount to chump change on the scale of such U.S. actions. The most provocative response to the CIA's allegations came from former State Department employee Peter Van Buren. "This is an attempted coup," he wrote, "as sure as it would be if there were tanks on the White House lawn." The CIA might as well have tried to shoot Trump during his next trip to Dallas. To date, all of these accusations have been based on anonymous sources and leaks. And we are also easily manipulated, liberals, progressives, who have rightly attacked the CIA for decades for domestic spying, WMD lies, overthrowing foreign governments, tortured drones, renditions, etc. Overnight now, believe and support every word the agency says, end quote. That's from Peter Van Buren, a now retired 24-year veteran of the State Department, who spent a year in Iraq, after which he wrote, quote, "We meant well, how we helped lose the battle for the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people." On another front, not long after the first two of some 50 Lockheed Martin F-35 Joint Strike fighters arrived in Israel, delayed by 6 hours because of fog, Trump vowed through a tweet to corral the, quote, out-of-control cost of the supposedly stealth jet fighter, the most expensive by far ever built at more than $100 million each. But according to Defense News, congressional members of both parties, conscious of the thousands of jobs the aircraft generates in 45 states, will resist plans by Trump to cut the program. The F-35's nearly $400 billion price tag makes it the Pentagon's most expensive weapons acquisition ever. Lockheed Martin's stock tumbled after Trump's tweet, wiping out nearly $2 billion of the company's market value. Last month, Israel ordered 17 more of the often troubled aircraft under the 10-year, $38 billion U.S. military aid package for Israel signed by Obama in September. Six of them are due to be delivered next year, all of them apparently courtesy of U.S. taxpayers, most of whom have not the faintest notion of what is being done with their money. And that's not all. A day ahead of a government shutdown deadline last Thursday, by overwhelming margins, Congress approved a defense spending bill, put that defense in quotes, that provides more than $600 million for missile defense cooperation with Israel, money that's not included in the foreign aid budget. The Senate, by a 92-7 vote, came a week after the House approved the measure 375-34. The same bill also included, at long last, $170 million to address the ongoing problems with Flint, Michigan's lead poisoned water system. This is a hard, very long, hard-fought victory, Michigan Congressman Debbie Stabenow said in a statement provided to media. Hard-fought is what can never be said about U.S. aid to Israel when it comes to Congress. Clearly, members of Congress have learned their priorities. This has been Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.
Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Drew Courtney of People for the American Way, who discusses why he believes the nomination of Senator Jeff Sessions as Attorney General is among Donald Trump's most dangerous picks and should be staunchly opposed. Benjamin Shriver of Friends of the Earth, who talks about Trump's nominees for federal environment and energy posts, that underscores his intention to eviscerate environmental and climate regulations. And Rebecca Vilcomerson, Executive Director of Jewish Voice for Peace, who explains why her group and other Jewish organizations oppose Trump's nomination of David Friedman to be U.S. Ambassador to Israel. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Former British Labour leader Ed Miliband has laid out a new strategy for a soft Brexit, which he says would allow the UK to remain in the European Union's unified market after Brexit takes effect. He argues that safeguarding the strength of the economy should be the number one priority in negotiations over leaving the EU, rather than a focus on the undeliverable promise of reducing the number of immigrants to tens of thousands a year. But divisions within Labour over immigration policy have created deep problems for the party, which has lost recent by-elections. Party leader Jeremy Corbyn is resisting calls by some in Labour to push for a reduction in the number of EU immigrants. Recent polls show Labour at its lowest point since the early days of Margaret Thatcher. The party is now 17 percentage points behind the Tories, led by Prime Minister Theresa May, who will formally launch Brexit talks in March. Miliband and other Labour leaders are working to create a united front with Labour supporters in big cities like London that overwhelmingly opposed Brexit, while many in the party rank and file in old industrial towns of the north support strict curbs on immigration. For now, Miliband is focusing on avoiding economic costs, including the possible imposition of short-term tariffs on Britain if a hard Brexit is implemented. Founded in the early 1990s in Johannesburg, South Africa, the charity Gift of the Givers has grown into a global relief organization funded mostly by South African Muslims. Gift relief workers are seen providing assistance where global disasters strike. For 20 years, aid workers from the organization have helped those in need with emergency medical support in Haiti, Bosnia, and Bangladesh. Today, the charity runs hospitals in Syria and food kitchens for needy university students in Johannesburg. It runs a counseling hotline and has its own trademarked meal replacement supplement for the malnourished. But increasingly, Gift of the Givers has run into criticism from Western aid workers who assert the charity doesn't take a neutral stand in conflict zones such as Syria, where its volunteers have been observed embracing rebels from the Free Syrian Army. One aid worker, critical of the group, noted that the rejection of traditional neutrality for humanitarian groups doesn't mean Gift of the Givers' services are less valuable, but it does mean you can't stand up and say you're a principled, impartial actor in these situations. The charity's founder, Imtiaz Suleiman, told the Christian Science Monitor, "The Islamic teaching is very clear. Help people. It's not help black people or white people. It just says help people. It's such a broad category. That's what we do." In 2015, a group of prisoners serving time at the infamous Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola filed a class-action lawsuit charging that medical care at the prison violated the constitutional ban on cruel and unusual punishment. Plaintiff Shannon Hurd, who is serving a mandatory life sentence, unsuccessfully requested medical assistance for 5 years, complaining of severe pain. Over time, he felt numbness in his feet, legs, and fingertips. Eventually, a CT scan found Hurd had stage 4 cancer in both his kidneys and lungs. Dr. Anjali Niyogi, who runs a clinic for recently released inmates in New Orleans, told the news magazine In These Times, "We do see a lot of delayed cases coming out of Angola, people who honestly should have been seen by physicians years or months earlier." Today, emergency medical technicians, or EMTs, not doctors or physicians' assistants, are the medical gatekeepers at Angola. EMTs decide who receives care and who is turned away. Any inmate who is accused of faking an illness receives a disciplinary infraction, which can lead to punishment by being locked away in solitary confinement. As a result, many inmates in Angola are fearful of seeking health care. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Amid anti-Trump protests across the U.S., members of the Electoral College met at state capitals on December 19th. But despite millions of petition signatures and phone calls urging electors to switch their votes, the hoped-for upending of the nation's constitutionally mandated non-democratic Electoral College process failed. In the end, only two Republican electors from Texas voted against Trump, while five of Hillary Clinton's electors defected, three voting for ex-Secretary of State Colin Powell, one for a Native American tribal leader, and another for Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. The final Electoral College vote total was 304 votes for Trump and 227 for Clinton. But now, with that phase of the election over, Trump opponents are gearing up to battle many of the right-wing ideologue millionaires and billionaires that have been nominated or appointed to government posts. One of the most controversial Trump nominations is that of Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, named to become the nation's next attorney general. In 1986, Sessions was denied a federal judgeship by the Senate Republican majority due to charges that he held racist views and had a history of making racially insensitive remarks. While Senate Democrats don't have the votes to defeat the Sessions nomination, they will certainly question the Alabama senator about his extreme anti-immigrant views, support for torture of U.S.-held prisoners, and opposition to hate crimes protections for LGBTQ people. Your reporter spoke with Drew Courtney, communications director with the group People for the American Way, who explains why he believes that Mr. Trump's nomination of Jeff Sessions as attorney general is one of his most dangerous cabinet picks.
We really believe that Jeff Sessions is perhaps Donald Trump's most dangerous pick to join his cabinet. He has really made a name for himself as one of the most extreme members of the Senate on a number of issues, including voter suppression issues, including attacking immigrants, including Islamophobia, over a long period of time. He first came to national attention around his career as an assistant U.S. attorney in the early 1980s, where he was rejected for a judgeship. And he threw in very early with Donald Trump and was one of Donald Trump's most committed boosters throughout the campaign. And I think that, more than anything else, speaks to why he got the nod from President-elect Trump, which is actually frightening for a couple of reasons. The first is, I think in any other Republican administration, Sessions would not have been a serious contender. I don't think he's viewed as up to the job in a lot of ways. I don't think he was viewed as mainstream, even within the rather extreme Republican Party we're dealing with. And second of all, unlike other offices in the cabinet, it's really critical, or more critical in this particular position, that the attorney general operate independently of the president. They're not the president's lawyer. The attorney general is the people's lawyer, and sometimes that brings them into conflict with the administration. I think that we have a lot of reason to doubt that Jeff Sessions is up to the job or has much interest in being independent of Donald Trump. And that's really concerning because he's not there truly to serve the president. He's there to serve the people of the United States of America by upholding the law.
Drew, review for our listeners some of the most objectionable things that Jeff Sessions has said and done as a senator. And I want you to take into account some of the talking points of Trump supporters who say Jeff Sessions, when he was rejected as a federal judge nominee back in 1986, has changed a lot during the course of his being a senator, and that his views have mellowed or he's matured as a public official.
To be clear, I actually think we should be open to the idea that someone has changed in the last 30 years. Unfortunately for Jeff Sessions, he's spent that time in public life, and we can see that his attitudes have not changed. He's always been one of the most vocal opponents of voting rights reforms that have gone forward. So although he voted for the reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act, he was a cheerleader when the Supreme Court gutted it in Shelby County decision. That was one of the major decisions that led to all the voter suppression laws that we've seen in recent elections, and that made it much harder for folks to vote in this election. He's repeatedly demagogued and attacked immigrants of all kinds. He's really led the anti-immigrant caucus in the Senate, not just against undocumented immigrants, but also trying to reduce legal immigration, calling for a return to the early 20th century quota system that had much more generous quotas for nations where it were sending European immigrants as opposed to other countries. And on Islamophobia issues, again, he's been pretty aggressive in attacking, for instance, when the National Endowment for the Humanities was distributing material about Islam to some libraries as part of their broad mandate to be distributing libraries and research to all different kinds of institutions. He reached out and attacked them. One of the other issues that I think has probably not gotten enough attention is that he's also been really dangerous on issues related to women's equality. So he voted against the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. He was one of only a handful of senators to oppose the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act. And I think that's relevant because when he was supporting Donald Trump, when he was asked about his really horrible comments about grabbing women by their genitals, Jeff Sessions said, I don't really think that that counts as sexual assault, which is really disturbing because, again, he will be our nation's chief law enforcement officer, and he seems to have a very vague idea of what the law is. So on a really wide range of issues, I think we've not only seen a level of extremism that's disturbing, but we've seen again and again a real willingness to kind of put his own agenda before the law when it's convenient. When the law and his ideology conflict, he tends to go with ideology. And that's about the last quality you want to find in someone who's going to be your attorney general.
Drew, one of the biggest questions surrounding the nomination of Jeff Sessions to become the next U.S. attorney general is how the minority Democrats in the Senate will respond to that nomination when it comes to the confirmation hearings. What are we hearing from Democrats in terms of the weight they're willing to throw around and use of the filibuster possibly to keep Jeff Sessions at bay here or to defeat his nomination?
So because of the changes in the filibuster, Democrats have limited power in terms of blocking him on their own. So on lower federal courts, not the Supreme Court, but all the lower federal courts, and on all executive branch nominations, the vote margin for cutting off debate was lowered to a simple majority. So if Republicans can keep their caucus together, Democrats are not able to sustain a filibuster of someone like Sessions or any of the other Senate-confirmed nominees. Now, that doesn't mean that Democrats are completely without power. There are some other procedural rules that they can use. And, of course, they can pressure Republicans to do the right thing by calling out some of these concerns. So in committee, I think that they should be pushing really hard and asking some really tough questions. And I think that we have seen that attitude. Unfortunately, I don't think Republicans have been particularly receptive to that this time. But I do think that it's going to be really important that Democrats, both before and during the hearings, ask tough questions about the things that matter. You know, there need to be real questions to Jeff Sessions about whether or not it's constitutional for a president, any president, to set up a registry of folks of a particular religion. I think that he needs to commit very clearly that he understands that that's plainly unconstitutional. And if not, I think Republicans really need their feet held to the fire about why they're willing to support someone who would say that.
That was Drew Courtney, communications director with the group People for the American Way. Find more news and commentary on Trump's nomination of Senator Jeff Sessions for attorney general by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. When, as expected, Donald Trump won the Electoral College vote on December 19th, clearing the way for his presidential inauguration on January 20th, it was in keeping with the fact-free character of the 2016 campaign that more than half of the Republican candidate supporters believed that he had won the popular vote, when in fact Hillary Clinton won the election by some 2.8 million votes. Like Trump, many of his supporters also mistakenly believe that climate change is a hoax. According to an October Pew poll, 47% of those who back Trump say the Earth is warming because of natural patterns, while 30% believe there is no solid evidence that Earth is warming at all. Only 22% of those polled who support Trump say the Earth is warming mostly because of human activity, as is the conclusion of virtually all of the world's scientists. So it's no surprise that the reality TV star billionaire has nominated or appointed a long list of climate change deniers and fossil fuel industry executives to serve in his administration. Thus far, Trump has chosen Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt, a dedicated oil and gas industry supporter, to lead the Environmental Protection Agency. ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson has been nominated for Secretary of State, and Montana's freshman representative Ryan Zink has been named to become Secretary of the Interior. Your reporter spoke with Benjamin Schreiber, Climate and Energy Program Director with the group Friends of the Earth, who assesses Donald Trump's nominees for government, environment, and energy posts that underscores his obvious intention to eviscerate environmental protections and tear up existing regulations designed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions that contribute to climate change.
Yeah, it's really clear that Donald Trump is committed to eviscerating our governmental agencies and their ability to regulate. there's nothing more symbolic than, picking an attorney general from Oklahoma who's suing the Environmental Protection Agency to be its head, to show what his intent is. And it's not just, the EPA. It's also the Department of Energy with Governor Rick Perry, who, famously couldn't remember that he wanted to eradicate the entire agency as part of a presidential debate. And then with Rex Tillerson as your choice for your prime diplomat, your head diplomat, setting international policy for the United States based on the needs of the oil and gas industry. I think it very much shows that this president's going to have a transactional foreign policy that's very much a new sort of resource colonialism, where we protect corporate interests for companies like Exxon at the expense of human rights and other good governance aspects. And so I think it's a really dark period right now. And the thing to look at and to bring hope is the fact that he can't just be an emperor. He's not going to be able to just do everything he wants right away. We do have ways to stop him. And we've seen through protests like the Keystone XL pipeline and Dakota Access pipeline that people don't want to sit back and sit down and let him eviscerate our government regulations. And so there's going to be a fight on our hands for, at least the next 4 years.
What can you tell us about Attorney General Scott Pruitt of Oklahoma, who is Trump's pick to become head of the EPA? What's his background? What's he on the record as saying about the EPA and its regulations?
So, Scott Pruitt is the Attorney General of Oklahoma. He's taken hundreds of thousands of dollars from the oil and gas industry. Harold Hamm was the chair of his reelect committee for his last election as the co-chair. And under his watch while he was the AG, the oil and gas industry literally turned Oklahoma into an earthquake zone. You've had hundreds of earthquakes in Oklahoma in the last year that are the result of fracking and the energy extraction. The thing about Pruitt is even as he's turning over Oklahoma and helping turn Oklahoma over to the oil and gas industry, he's been suing the Environmental Protection Agency to stop them from implementing rules and regulations. And so now you literally have the fox in charge of the hen house. You have, an AG that's literally submitted letters and filed lawsuits on behalf of the oil and gas industry to try and stop EPA from regulating greenhouse gas emissions and other pollutants. And protecting water, you have him now defending those regulations and the right to regulate. And we can all guess that he's not going to do a very vigorous job in defending them and that he's going to try and write them to be much more friendly to the oil and gas industry and their profit line.
Well, Benjamin, just a final quick question. We don't have a lot of time left, but I wanted to ask you this. Where do you place the most faith in countering the Trump agenda on climate and the environment? You think an inside strategy of politics on the floor of the House or the Senate is an avenue that will be effective? Or do you think it's really going to take people out in the streets, really shaking to the foundations our institutions, whether they be government or media or all the above, to draw attention to the very real stakes, the very real danger posed by eviscerating both clean air, clean water, and climate regulations?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And it's clear from watching the Tea Party and the success that they've had, as well as the successes that the progressive movement has had with Keystone XL and Dakota Access, that the answer is the streets. We're in a situation right now where Democrats and progressives don't have a lot of political power. We need our constituencies to take to the streets to let Democratic members of the Senate know that there will be repercussions for going the right way and working with Trump and supporting his anti-environmental agenda, and to let Republicans know that there will be election prices moving forward. Because at the end of the day, most members of Congress are concerned with one thing, and that's being reelected. And so hearing from their constituencies their massive opposition to Trump's anti-environmental scheme will be the only thing that actually slows it down.
That was Benjamin Schreiber, Climate and Energy Program Director with Friends of the Earth. Learn more about how environmental groups are responding to the Trump agenda by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. President-elect Donald Trump's appointments and nominations have enraged and worried many Americans, no matter what their priorities, whether it's health care, labor rights, environment and climate change, or other issues. He's given the nod to individuals in many cases who have promised to destroy the very agencies they've been appointed to lead. In the realm of diplomacy, Trump has chosen as his ambassador to Israel the undiplomatic David Friedman, his bankruptcy lawyer, and someone who is to the right of Israel's right-wing leader, Benjamin Netanyahu. Friedman supports more Israeli construction for settlements in the occupied West Bank, advocates moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, and opposes a two-state solution, which the U.S. has claimed to support for decades, but which in reality it has undermined with its steadfast military support for Israel. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Rebecca Vilcomerson, Executive Director of Jewish Voice for Peace, one of the most progressive Jewish organizations in the U.S., which calls for Israeli withdrawal from Palestinian territories and a resolution of the Palestinian refugee problem, consistent with international law and equity. The group supports the Palestinian-initiated boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement as a way to reach those goals. Here, Vilcomerson explains how Friedman's nomination is bringing together groups that have not always seen eye to eye in order to oppose what they view as Trump's disastrous choice for Palestinians, Israelis, and for Americans working for Middle East peace.
David Friedman is someone who represents the most extreme right in the Israeli political spectrum. He's actually far to the right of Prime Minister Netanyahu himself. What Trump is broadcasting with this pick is that he's fully on board with a policy of apartheid and annexation and with no concern for Palestinian rights. There's an argument you could make that with this appointment, you know, it's sort of like casting off the mask because the United States has been supporting Israel as it pursues these policies for the last many years while we've continued to support them with, you know, military, financial, economic and diplomatic aid. And so this is just casting off that mask and saying it openly. But I think that's going to come at a really, really high human cost. So I think it's a very, very distressing appointment. I think the other thing to think about is that this does further isolate the United States in comparison to the rest of the world. So, for example, David Friedman has talked about moving the embassy to Jerusalem. And at this point, the U.S. has kept our embassy in Tel Aviv as every other country in the world does. And so, you know, there's an international consensus that moving the embassy to Jerusalem would essentially saying to Israel that it's okay to annex and to keep the occupied territories, which it has in 1967. So that's a really, really provocative move to make. And again, it would further isolate the United States from the international consensus and from international law. Now that, again, may be an opportunity for those of us in the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, BDS, to put more pressure on Israel. But it certainly would be something that I think would be quite of terrible concern to Palestinians. And it also is, you know, it's bad for people in Israel who are seeking peace, who are really going to be disempowered by this move.
Rebecca Vilcomerson, speaking of working together with other organizations to oppose this nomination, I heard that Friedman was excoriating J Street, which is a pretty middle-of-the-road organization that calls itself pro-Israel and pro-peace. And I wonder if you could say what Jewish Voice for Peace's relationship has been up to now with J Street, if any, and what may possibly change as a result of this appointment.
Yeah, I mean, look, the first thing I have to say is that the kind of language that David Friedman was using towards J Street was absolutely appalling and reprehensible. You know, he called J Street members and J Street self capos, which is, you know, one of the worst insults you can hurl at someone. You know, it's basically saying it's the equivalent of the Jewish people who were forced to help the Nazis in the concentration camps. That's the farthest thing from diplomatic language, but even more than the language that I'm concerned about, it's the idea that those kind of insults and dismissal of a very significant swath of the Jewish community is a legitimate thing to do, which it absolutely is not. you know, and our relationship to J.C. has been one of, you know, there's a lot of overlap, I think, in terms of people who have sometimes started as J Street members and eventually moved on to JVP. And they take a different approach than we do. We've been on opposite sides many, many times because they have actively worked against the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. And so, you know, that's a big concern. But at the same time, they're opposing David Friedman's appointment. And sometimes we come out on the same sides of issues. So we're eager to work with different people that we can when we come out on the same sides of the issue. And when we come out on different sides of the issue, we're going to oppose them actively. And I think that, you know, the Trump administration is going to realign a lot of organizations in the Jewish community and far beyond the Jewish community. There is, I think, you know, a great concern about the fact of a lot of the bigger Jewish institutions like AIPAC and the Jewish Federations have not condemned, for example, Steve Bannon, who ran Breitbart before he worked for Trump and is now the chief strategist for Trump. And he's someone who is welcomed into Breitbart and given a platform on Breitbart to people who are Islamophobic and racist and misogynistic and anti-Semitic. And so we have, you know, sort of anti-Semitism is reaching a proximity to power that it hasn't had in my generation. And much to my shame and, to be honest, rage, a lot of those bigger Jewish institutions have not called that out. And that's because they feel like as long as those people like that are supporting Israel, that they don't need to worry about the actual anti-Semitism that they're promoting.
That was Rebecca Vilcomerson, executive director of the group Jewish Voice for Peace, which has 65 chapters across the U.S. Find links to more analysis of David Friedman's nomination as Trump's new U.S. ambassador to Israel by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Elena Sowski, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Consider some things that need to be said, that have not yet been said. What we're about to see are the stirrings of a white counter-revolution. Let's not mince words. Make America great again? That meant white again. Trump's campaign began with a lie and ended with dozens of them. So desperate are white workers for relief from the rigors of today's neoliberal economy, think NAFTA, for example, that they fled to an alleged billionaire for succor and safety. When have billionaires ever really cared for the poor? Billionaires care about money. That's why they're billionaires. But Donald Trump's trump card wasn't class. It was race. And he ran a campaign that the KKK would love. Prepare for a political roller coaster. The Trump show, full of glitz and hits, is about to raise the curtain. It won't be boring, that I can bet you. It won't be pretty. It can't be pretty. Because the election wasn't pretty. It's only going to get uglier. Get ready for one hell of a ride. Welcome to Trump land. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Considering his slaughter of 9 souls in a black church in Charleston. For in the next few days and weeks, a jury will convene to decide whether he gets a death sentence or life. As someone who lived a lifetime on death row, my opposition is unequivocal. Even in a case such as this, my opposition to the state taking life doesn't falter. Even in this case, of a witless white supremacist, a killer of 9 black Christian souls. If I know anything, I know death row. I've seen it drive men stark, raving mad. That said, my one opinion carries no real weight in this case, for unless I miss my guess, no juror will ever hear these words. They will decide his fate after he delivers his own closing arguments, which will hardly endear him to his jurors. A death verdict for Roof strengthens the repressive powers of the state and gives it the false aura of justice. If a death sentence fails, it helps slow the inherent injustice of the death penalty. It will help all of the men and women on death row. My decision to oppose death for Roof wasn't an easy one, but I believe it's the right one. No matter his beliefs, decades on death row, as with decades in solitary, are mind-frying experiences. Nothing he has experienced in his brief life can prepare him for such outcomes. For life in prison ain't no picnic. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Castro's funeral. In the 1950s, Fulgencio Batista ruled Cuba as the dictator, occasionally allowing rigged elections. Batista and the ruling elite of Cuba thrived on American bribes, turning their island into a Caribbean Las Vegas. The population lived short, cruel lives, with the highest infant mortality rate
and the lowest literacy rate in the hemisphere. After one particularly obviously fixed election, a young upstart lawyer named Fidel Castro challenged the results. When that failed, Castro set his mind on orchestrating a revolution. He joined a group that laid siege to the Moncada barracks, hoping to gain access to the armory and to arm the Cuban people, toppling the Batista regime. Moncada failed, and Castro was sent to prison for life. At his sentencing, Castro issued a firebrand declaration that concluded with a prescient prediction that history would vindicate him. After years in prison, Castro was released when someone bribed Batista, and Castro was sent into exile in Mexico, where he met up with a revolutionary Cuban expatriate group and an Argentine named Che Guevara. Castro immediately set his mind again to toppling Batista. Castro's crew attempted to buy a PT boat so they could sail to Cuba and undertake guerrilla warfare, but the deal for the boat fell through. With no other options, the group purchased a yacht from a Cuban expat retired in Mexico. Castro and friends crammed more than 100 people onto that yacht with food and water for the journey. The plan was to rendezvous with a contingent in Cuba who would have weapons waiting on the beach. But nobody checked the weather first, so they sailed directly into a hurricane. Because the yacht was sailing so heavy with more than 100 people, it took on water. The salt water shorted out the electricity, killing all navigation and refrigeration. So they sailed blind and all their food spoiled. In the days that Castro and his crew sailed in circles out in the ocean, patrols discovered the contingent on the Cuban beach and arrested them and confiscated all their guns. The Cuban military waited in ambush. When Castro's crew finally figured out where they were and sailed toward Cuba, they were starving and dehydrated and hurricane-weary. As they approached the island, planes flew over, dropping bombs. Soldiers fought. In response, the revolutionaries panicked and ran aground on a sandbar, stranded 100 yards from shore. So under fire and with bombs dropping from the sky, the 100-plus guerrillas dove into the ocean and swam for the beach. In the chaos that followed, most of the survivors ran up the beach and into the jungle and found their way back to their respective homes, resuming their non-revolutionary lives. But not all. A local farmer discovered a handful of cold and shivering, hungry people wandering in the jungle around his farm. Since it was raining season, the farmer brought those wandering guerrillas to his barn and gave them food and blankets. There were 12 of them. They had 4 operable firearms between them and very little ammunition. They were exhausted and cold and wet, and their leader, the brains of this operation, was a failed revolutionary who had already been sent to prison once and had sailed them into a hurricane and into a sandbar and into failure after failure. There, in that barn, the 12 of them had to decide what to do moving forward. They decided to load their 4 weapons and wage irregular warfare against a mechanized and technologically advanced military of 80,000 soldiers that had the full backing of the United States government. 18 months later, Fulgencio Batista fled Havana and went into exile with a suitcase full of cash. What began with 12 shivering, hapless dreamers in a barn ended with the toppling of a tyrant. The significance of the Cuban Revolution is that at no time did the guerrilla forces number more than 5,000. It occurred just miles off of the shore of Florida. And, as an example for us, the Cuban Revolution proved that we don't have to wait for conditions in order to instigate or provoke rebellion. That once an insurrection begins, it becomes contagious. What Castro and those revolutionaries accomplished in ousting a dictator can be duplicated by Zapatistas in Mexico, or Sandinistas in Nicaragua, or by you and me right here, right now. Political violence works. Want to change the world? You only need 12 guerrillas, 4 guns, and a yacht. Now, all that said, Castro was a hierarch. So after leading the rebellion that successfully ousted a dictator, Castro ceased being a guerrilla and assumed the swivel chair behind the former dictator's desk. As a head of state, Castro can be criticized for political repression and for not allowing elections, although much of that was influenced greatly by the constant threat of U.S. interference and sabotage. Had Castro permitted free elections, the CIA would have funded an electoral coup.
But Castro, the head of state, is not the example that speaks to all of us. I think we can easily distinguish between Castro the guerrilla, who opposed the existing power through political violence, and the later disappointing Castro, who became the existing power. Castro the rebel stared down a ruthless terror state and declared that history would vindicate him. May history vindicate us as well. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Warren Correctional Institution, Lebanon, Ohio. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain, 243-205, Warren CI, P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio, 45036. For updates on his situation and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org.
What you're about to hear is a repeat broadcast of the Global Research News Hour, which originally aired on February 5th, 2016. In this special interview featuring academic, author, and American Indian Movement member Ward Churchill, we talk about the case of Leonard Peltier. Peltier was sentenced to two consecutive life sentences for the death of FBI agents Jack Kohler and Ronald Williams during a shootout at the Pine Ridge Reservation in June of 1975. It is widely believed that Peltier is innocent of the crime. Amnesty International placed his case among their list of unfair trials and is now championing an effort to lobby outgoing U.S. President Barack Obama to grant Peltier a pardon before he leaves office. Peltier has been behind bars now for four decades. His health is reported to be deteriorating. He has suffered a stroke and lost 90% of the sight in one eye. He has heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, a long-endured maxillofacial jaw problem, and recently an unaddressed abdominal aortic aneurysm. According to his doctor, he's in urgent need of prostate surgery. Recently, he suffered the loss of his youngest son. He's now 71, and his next parole hearing date is July 2024. His prospects of making it to that date are not promising. President Obama is the only man alive who can set Peltier free. Listeners to this program are encouraged to write the president and call for Peltier's expeditious release. There is a special Canadian connection in that Peltier had crossed the border to Canada following the shootout with the agents, but was extradited back to the U.S. based on FBI documents, which Canada's Solicitor General would later admit contained false information. Peltier's conviction and imprisonment followed. Canadian listeners are especially encouraged to write to the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and encourage him to use his special relationship with President Obama to lobby the president to set Peltier free. With less than 30 days left in Obama's term, listeners should send their correspondence to the president and the prime minister as quickly as possible. For more on the case and the campaign to set Peltier free, please visit the site www.freepelciernow.org. The World Health Organization declared the Zika virus a global health emergency on Monday, February 1st, without providing much detail on the disease. The sexually transmitted virus has been around for 69 years and is marketed by two companies, LGC Standards, headquartered in the UK, and ATCC, headquartered in the US. And who owns the patent on the virus? The Rockefeller Foundation. Why has the issue of patent ownership of the Zika virus not been the object of media coverage? That comes from the article, Who Owns the Zika Virus? By Guillaume Cress, posted February 3rd. The U.S. falsely blamed Iraq for playing a role in the 9/11 attacks, as shown by a memo from the Defense Secretary, as one of the main justifications for launching the Iraq War. Top U.S. government officials now admit that the Iraq War was really launched for oil, not 9/11 or weapons of mass destruction.
Despite previous lone wolf claims, many U.S. government officials now say that 9/11 was state-sponsored terror, but Iraq was not the state which backed the hijackers. Many U.S. officials have alleged that 9/11 was a false flag operation by rogue elements of the U.S. government, but such a claim is beyond the scope of this discussion. The key point is that the U.S. falsely blamed it on Iraq when it knew Iraq had nothing to do with it. That comes from the article, 58 Admitted False Flag Attacks, by Washington's blog, posted February 3rd. PricewaterhouseCoopers recently published the results of a survey that collected the opinions of 1,409 CEOs of 83 countries on the economic panorama. 66% of those interviewed considered that their corporate organizations face greater threats today than 3 years ago, and only 27% think that global growth will improve. The uncertainty is such that during the Davos summit, there was no consensus among business giants as to when the next crisis will hit. With this, the Western press did not hesitate to point out that the deceleration of China is the principal cause of the turbulence in the world economy. In fact, George Soros, who hit the pound sterling in the 1990s, maintained in Davos that a violent landing of the Chinese economy is inevitable, without doubt, an exaggerated affirmation. In my judgment, there is a propaganda campaign against Beijing that attempts to hide the serious economic and social contradictions that persist in the industrialized countries, the United States, Germany, France, the United Kingdom, Japan, etc. That comes from the article, Where Will the Next Global Economic Crisis Explode? Colossal Stock Market Losses in 2016, by Ariel Noyola Rodriguez, posted February 3rd, originally appearing in Spanish on Russia Today. So implementing a ceasefire is the UN's top priority, as it is Washington's. But why would Putin agree to a ceasefire now, just when the Russian-led coalition is making great strides on the battlefield, the war's momentum has shifted in his favor, and the jihadist militias appear to be on the ropes? He probably won't agree to a ceasefire, nor will he agree to have Assad be removed by force of arms, but he might be willing to ease up on his current military offensive and even allow the U.S. to retain captured territory in eastern Syria that could be used for future pipeline corridors, if he thought that Russia would benefit from the deal. What if the Saudis, acting on behalf of their friends in Washington, offered to cut back production so prices began to rise and Russia's economy started to rebound? That comes from the article, Oil Price Treachery. Are the Saudis blackmailing Putin for concessions on Syria? By Mike Whitney, posted February 3rd, originally appearing at Counterpunch. On November 16, 2015, F. William Engdahl headlined, Do We Really Want a New World War with Russia? And he itemized the ways in which Russia's military performance in both Ukraine and Syria has shocked the U.S. and its allies, especially any U.S. president who would continue the effort started in 1990 by President George Herbert Walker Bush to conquer and grab control of the resources of post-communist Russia is insane, especially now after the February 2014 U.S.-run coup in Ukraine crossed the line that Russia had repeatedly warned must not be crossed. If this effort ever stops, the news media won't report the U.S. gang's retreat from this by now 25-year-long war against Russia, which those same news media have consistently refused to report. But even if they were to report it, no obligation by the West is so important as the obligation to stop it, the obligation to call off the West's Saudi, Qatari, Turkish, UAE, Kuwaiti finance, Sunni terrorists, and the rest of the West's, via NATO, the IMF, etc., war against Russia and against Russia's Shiite and BRICS allies. That comes from the article, How Corruption Cripples America's Military, U.S. versus Russian Weaponry, Who Wins? By Eric Zeus, posted February 3rd. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Saturday, February 6th, marks Leonard Peltier's 40th year in prison. He's been serving two consecutive life sentences for the first-degree murders of two federal agents during a famous firefight which took place on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in 1975. Peltier's incarceration is widely perceived as unjust as well as politically motivated. Given his alliance with the American Indian Movement at a time when that organization posed a challenge to U.S. federal authorities. One man who's familiar with this case is Ward Churchill. He's written and spoken extensively on not only Peltier, but on the way the Federal Bureau of Investigation has contained popular struggles against colonial power. Ward Churchill served as professor of ethnic studies at the University of Colorado Boulder from 1990 until 2007. His work focuses on the U.S. government's historical treatment of political dissenters and resistors. Ward Churchill has long been affiliated with the American Indian Movement of Colorado and was a resident of the Northern Plains, Colorado region before moving to Atlanta in 2013, where he continues his writing and research. He has authored several books, including 1988's Agents of Repression, the FBI's Secret Wars Against the Black Panther Party and the American Indian Movement with Jim Vanderwall from South End Press, 1990's The COINTELPRO Papers, documents from the FBI's Secret War Against Domestic Dissent, again with Jim Vanderwall, also from South End Press, and 2003's On the Justice of Roosting Chickens, Reflections on the Consequences of U.S. Imperial Arrogance and Criminality from AK Press. I had a chance recently to interview Ward Churchill. During our conversation, we explored the history of U.S. state counterinsurgency warfare, the so-called COINTELPRO program, American Indian Movement involvement in the Pine Ridge Oglala Nation region in what is called South Dakota, and the famous case of Leonard Peltier. Here is that conversation. I wanted to help provide us some historical context, because as I understand it, this has been an evolution of already existing practices within the FBI going back to the early 20th century, which cracked down on groups like the Industrial Workers of the World and the Communists.
Well, actually, it goes back even further than the early 20th century. You find the origins of this. I don't want to take it too far, because you can find the actual origins in France and so on, the early part of the 19th century. But it emerges in the Pinkerton Detective Agency, which is the precursor of the FBI, after the so-called Civil War down here. Pinkerton Detective Agency was the entity that was retained by the newly formed Justice Department of the United States to perform investigative work with regard to violation of federal law, ostensibly at least. But quite a lot of that activity, Pinkerton activity, went to enforcing the status quo, moneyed interests and so forth, in a manner consistent with what federal government wanted to see accomplished, that is, do with developing the railroad net in this country and development of heavy industry and so forth. Went to attacking the labor movement, went to keeping the racial status quo in effect and so forth. And a lot of the techniques that were used with regard to the Molly Maguires in the Pennsylvania coal fields, for example, these were the pioneering techniques of political repression that were perfected in concert with the federal government and various state governments and major corporate interests, infiltration of agents provocateurs, that is, people who are infiltrated to engage, propose whatever criminal activity that could be used into mount ostensibly non-political criminal charges against particularly select key activists and so forth, political assassination, either de facto or de jure, de facto by extra legal use of the criminal justice system to accomplish neutralization, as it becomes known, of key activists and sometimes massive repression of rank-and-file membership, but also de jure, which is to say literally using state forces, often in clandestine fashion, to effect outright assassinations of targeted activists. Disinformation campaigns, which come to do with the issuance of black and gray propaganda. Black propaganda often attributed falsely to political activists themselves. Gray propaganda having to do with essentially what we would now call spin to affect a general popular discrediting of political movements, orchestration of false charges in the judicial system, political imprisonment. They've literally had facilities that were designated pretty much continuously since the late part of the 19th century to hold political activists. Activists in the sense we ordinarily understand them, but also activists in the sense the status quo understands them, which has to do with the rank and file union membership, for example, the membership of political organizations and so on could be consigned to special facilities. They constructed camps in Idaho to basically round up United Mine Workers membership or Western Federation of Mine Workers or miners membership en masse. You had that occur also in Arizona. Now, these are nominally private entities, these detective agencies, and Pinkerton was the most prominent, but you had Burns Detective Agency and a number of others that came into being because there was great demand for the sort of operative service to orchestrate the disruption and to gather intelligence. Pinkerton was right clear about the key to all politically repressive efforts, maintaining order, as they called it, had to do with knowing what was going on and who was in the process of doing it at all times. And so you had this nationwide informant net that was concocted, created. People who were nominally members of activist organizations, people who would provide information based upon political disagreements, competitiveness, petty jealousies. They worked on all of this and still do. Because what you're seeing emerge out of the Pinkertons, which is that entity was replaced as the investigative agency, as you say, in the early part of the 20th century by what was initially simply called the Bureau of Investigation. It doesn't become the Federal Bureau of Investigation until the 1930s.
But, now, just in terms of these...
Those techniques form the template for what becomes COINTELPRO ultimately. But you have the repression of the labor movement, particularly immigrants, in the early part of the 20th century. The anarchist movement was especially targeted, and the IWW stuff ties to that, with the so-called Palmer raids, nationwide raids on immigrant labor halls and so forth that occurred in 1919, 1920, nationwide mass deportations and mass incarcerations and the targeting of the Communist Party and the Communist Workers' Party, or Communist Labor Party, excuse me, came right out of that in the 1920s. Supposedly, there's a period after the Palmer raids because they were so visible at the time, so draconian in their approach that liberal establishment was appalled and they put an end to it. And J. Edgar Hoover, the famous FBI director for life, was installed on the basis of a promise that the FBI would be, or the Bureau of Investigation as it was known at the time, would no longer engage in political surveillance and repression activities, but never stopped. It never stopped.
That whole
idea continued through the 1920s and really took off again in the 1930s.
So when we come to the era in the 1960s and the emergence of COINTELPRO, in what ways was that distinct from the previous efforts? Was it merely a refinement of previous methods?
Or? Yeah, it's a centralization and rendering it more systematic. COINTELPRO, you know, that's an acronym, or more properly, you might put it as a cryptonym because it was a secret program during its formal duration. Simply means counterintelligence program. Now, what's different about this innocuous sounding counterintelligence program captioned COINTELPRO is that it is specifically focused on domestic dissidents. Mm-hmm. Now, when you're targeting agents of foreign powers, the standard constitutional protections and so forth do not apply, all right? That's as a matter of law. You can do things to neutralize a Soviet spy or a German spy earlier on, and so forth that you cannot do to a U.S. citizen. The point of a counterintelligence operation is, and I'm paraphrasing an FBI official explaining it, is to neutralize the target by whatever means. You can do that by killing them. You can do that by exposing them. You can do that by discrediting them. You can do that by what's called badjacking them, convincing their intelligence agency that they become double agents and they may be liquidated then by their own organization, and so on and so on and so on. Now, none of these are legal in the context of constitutional protections in the United States, but given essentially war, in the context of war, these are enemy agents that are not U.S. citizens.
So neutralizing
all these techniques, they created a rationalization. This is what the secret program to systematically utilize these techniques, these counterintelligence techniques against U.S. dissidents, U.S. citizens. It's not counterintelligence. It's counter subversion. And at a certain point in their own documents, it becomes counterinsurgency because they're referring to targets, particularly in the American Indian movement, not in terms of being radicals or political extremists, but in terms of being insurgents. Well, if you're going after insurgents, combat insurgents, it's by definition counterinsurgency. This is a technique of war. So war was mounted against American Indian movement, but arguably, although that particular vernacular was not employed against the Black Panther Party and other political organizations in the late 1960s, early 1970s, on, I would argue, right on through to today.
Mm. So you were just mentioning the Black Panther Party, and that seemed to be one of the most dynamic threats to the establishment. And so I guess I don't know if you want to say some words about how that the success that the COINTELPRO program had in undermining that efforts. I mean, if there's just maybe a couple of a couple of the main features of that crackdown that appears to have done them in.
Well, it's not a crackdown, okay? They're not cracking down on criminal activity. They're criminalizing. They're misrepresenting, often using their own operatives that have been infiltrated in the organization to make statements that they could record, then print in the press in order to misrepresent the positions and policies of the organization targeted, in this case, the Black Panther Party. Black Panther Party was actually a lawful organization, you see. The problem was it was a black organization. And so when they availed themselves of this revered Second Amendment right of American citizens to bear arms in public, okay, and to defend themselves against unwarranted aggression and all the rest of that. Well, this is black folk with guns. This is unacceptable. They actually start in California where this begins. They changed the law to delegitimate what had always been perfectly legitimate practice simply because it was black people doing it. And if you look at the 10-point program of the Black Panther Party, it had a self-determining component to it, obviously, but primarily was based on, hey, equal rights under the law and community self-sufficiency and all these good things that the status quo is always saying it wants black people to do when they were actually doing it.
Yeah, it does seem strange to me.
On that basis. Yeah. On that basis, J. Edgar Hoover proclaimed the Black Panther Party to be the number one internal security threat to the United States. That's all 5,000-odd black members of the Black Panther Party. Now, the preeminent internal security threat to the United States is an inner-city-based organization of 5,000 members, then there is no particular internal security threat to the United States, except that the message of the Panthers was, you know, if you've got an equitable situation, you change it by taking charge of your own affairs. Do for yourself. Organize the community, the resources of the community to meet community needs, and do not be dependent upon those who are oppressing you to fulfill them.
Is that what the real threat of the party was, that they were actually setting up things like, you know, feeding people and education and all of that, rather than the gun aspect that, you know, the NRA should conceivably be in full sympathy with?
Well, they had a problem with the guns because that created a certain parity with the police, at least symbolically. And that won't do because blacks are to be subjugated, okay? They're to be intimidated, cowed into accepting things that are absolutely unacceptable because the alternatives were even worse. And when you say you got a right to defend yourself, including from a cop who is violating your rights, which is, there's all kinds of judicial precedent on that in the United States, you know, that changes the calculus. It changed the calculus of police violence directed against the black community in Oakland dramatically in a single year, the Panther Street Patrols. Well, that's the antithesis of what those in charge want to see happen. And so, yeah, a whole lot of propaganda was made in the basis of the armed component of the Panther program, but it was a self-defense, and articulated such a self-defense posture, not an aggressive posture, not an attack of the police. It's defend yourself when the police attack you. You see, big difference. They always talk about the violence-prone Panthers, but it was the Panthers who were getting shot, so I don't know what their violence propensity was. What, attacking police bullets with their chests? Mm-hmm. You got 30-odd dead Panthers pretty much before you ever see,
of course,
any casualties on the other side. So even when it becomes firefights, straight-up firefights between the Panthers and the police, the Panthers are defending themselves against attack. But yes, in answer to your earlier question, the Breakfast for Children program that you mentioned in particular was named number one priority for destruction by Hoover himself. The idea that the blacks could organize in a manner which would render their oppressed communities self-sufficient was absolutely to be halted because they would then not be in this subjugated posture. And what that is a defense of the key word, order. You know, there's that old cliche about, it comes out of the anal compulsion of German households for orderliness. There's a place for everything, and everything's in its place. Well, this is the social corollary. There's a place for everyone, and everyone is to remain in their place. And you can see the place assigned to black folk. You can see the place assigned for the Mexican population north of the Rio Bravo. You can see the place to which Asian immigrants were assigned, and you can certainly see the place to which American Indians were assigned in the racial hierarchy, the structure of white supremacism in the United States then and now.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Pine Ridge Reservation is located in what is known as South Dakota at the border with Nebraska. U.S. surveyors had strategic interest in the territory owing to the rich uranium and molybdenum deposits situated there. However, in order to gain control of those deposits, the federal government would be legally required to forge a deal with the reservation's tribal government. The Lakota people were by and large hostile to any deals that would see more of their territory yielded to the feds. As a result, U.S. federal authorities arranged to have a local stooge named Dickie Wilson take charge. Ward Churchill described Wilson as a plumber and bootlegger. With the resources he received from outside, Wilson was able to secure a powerful base in the community. However, the nepotism and other corrupt practices he allegedly embraced proved too much for other community members to endure, so an opposition formed, calling itself the Oglala Sioux Civil Rights Organization, or OSCRO, and orchestrated an impeachment process. Wilson was able to defend himself by financing a kind of paramilitary called the Guardians of Oglala Nation, or Goons, which reported directly to him and was set up to intimidate the opposition. Ward Churchill explained what happened next and how Leonard Peltier and the American Indian Movement got involved in the community.
At that point, they began to fund Wilson with basically highway funds to establish what was initially called the Tribal Rangers Group, becomes known as the Goon Squads, quite appropriately. Wilson's Goons, which is a paramilitary force, and they were trying to intimidate the OSCRO people. They were getting serious resistance to that. You had a spike in violence occurring on Pine Ridge. They sent in this 60-man special operations group of federal marshals, as they called it, in baby blue jumpsuits to set up machine gun positions and right on top of the tribal building sandbag positions. And you had these guys patrolling with basically military hardware to maintain order during the impeachment. Okay. In effect, Wilson was then named to preside over his own impeachment hearing, and he sent out tribal police, which was heavily overlapped with this goon squad that we're talking about. Two-thirds of the tribal police are known members of the goon squad by the time this is done. Arrested the tribal council members who were opposed to him, so that only his own guys were sitting at the impeachment hearing over that he has his own. He basically named the chair himself and then told the chair what to say and began the impeachment by running a short film put out by the John Birch Society called Anarchy USA, basically saying his oppositions wanted to instill anarchy as a condition of life on the reservation, and it was his explanation of why he had to be retained. And then, you know, everybody voted. Everybody that was not in a jail cell, which were all of his own appointees or his surrogates, basically. And so I think there were four people voted. That's all of the tribal council that was actually there, but whatever it was, report was he was unanimously continued in office. And he immediately then came out and issued a ban, a public statement, issued a ban on meetings, political meetings on Pine Ridge Reservation. Well, that's when the old people called for American Indian Movement to come to Pine Ridge. In effect, American Indian Movement and the Oglala resistance went to Wounded Knee to convene a glorified press conference and were immediately surrounded by Wilson's goons. And shortly after the goons had established their roadblocks, the marshals were setting up roadblocks in conjunction with that, and then the FBI showed up, and then the Army advisors were sent from the White House, and there you have it. So you have this 71-day siege that's always called the Occupation of Wounded Knee. Well, they didn't go there to occupy the place, you know, other than temporarily, as I say, for purposes of attracting media attention, getting the message out of what was happening on Pine Ridge. But they certainly got media attention on the basis of this 71-day siege when you've got armored personnel carriers provided by to the federal authorities by the South Dakota National Guard, and you've got machine guns on full display, and you've got 500,000 rounds of gunfire exchanged, and you've got two marshal, well, one marshal, one FBI guy hit, two Indians killed, about 20 people seriously wounded. So you got a lot of media play, a lot of public attention.
Interesting.
But then you've also got a specialist in political repression, a guy by the name of Richard G. Held. Richard Held is instrumental in setting up the counterinsurgency operation that occurs in Pine Ridge in the aftermath of Wounded Knee. This is basically the method that was being used by the CIA in Latin America at the time, that they would enlist the local police forces and components of the military and so forth,
mm-hmm.
forming death squads, and that's exactly what they were called in Latin America. Those who were the strong traditionals were requesting, in many cases, and this is true with regard to the Peltier case, at the Jumping Bull property outside Oglala, they had requested. They've been harassed by the goons. They felt threatened. These are old people, Harry and Cecilia, Jumping Bull. They requested the security be provided by American Indian Movement and the Northwest AIM Group, which is Leonard Peltier, Bob Robidoux, Dino Butler in particular, but it's a somewhat larger group than that.
Mm-hmm.
Provided they set up a camp down by Cottonwood Creek to secure the property and to protect these old people and the younger members of the family as well, from goon violence. And so that was taken as a target. The FBI basically had made the decision that we will break the back of the American Indian Movement and the Oglala resistance right here, right now. You know, we thought they would have given up long before this, but they haven't. So we need to really have a major incident that can justify the introduction of overwhelming force. Well, they got that with the Oglala firefight. They got two dead agents.
Essentially a public relations exercise. Yeah.
Two dead FBI agents, that makes headlines. And they hyped it beyond belief that it was, they were lured into an ambush. Well, there was no ambush. And they were fired on with automatic weapons from fixed positions once they'd been lured into the kill zone. There were no fixed positions, and there were no automatic weapons. You even had a report come out of there within about 24 hours that the agents had been scalped. None of which was true, and the FBI knew it because immediately after the firefight, they had control of the ground. Okay? They had the bodies. They knew there were no fixed positions. There was no indication, and they knew that because the firefight went on for a considerable period of time. They were taking no automatic weapons fire, and on and on and on. When Tom Cole was the FBI spokesman who convened the press conference, put out the disinformation to make the headlines to justify what they were going to do next, he flat lied about all of it, and he knew the was lying. Okay. He knew you could make, if you want to be an apologist for the FBI, you can say that FBI Director Clarence Kelly, when he repeated the same stuff in L.A. a day after that, he may not have known the details because he was not there, but Tom Cole and the agents who were on the scene definitely did know. Okay, so disinformation was put out about that.
Mm-hmm. And
there was an Indian man killed that day, too, by the name of Joe Stuntz. Unmentioned, they put together what they call resmers investigation, reservation murders. Well, they weren't investigating all these murders that we've been talking about. They're investigating only the deaths of the two agents, and not even Joe Stuntz, who was killed at the same time. Yeah, and what they wanted to do was target people who were clearly committed AIM members and from off the reservation if they could. There were a lot of locals who were in a jumping bull, a game camp, were on the jumping bull property that day who were involved in the firefight. This was known to the FBI, too. They targeted for charges only members of the Northwest AIM group. So they're trying to divide the locals from the non-locals, divide the Indians, even the resistant Indians, against one another.
Yeah.
The us versus them. So you're getting local people who they don't know what to do in the condition. They want to protect their local boys. And so, well, you got these dead agents, and that clearly happened in 250-odd militarily equipped FBI agents pouring onto that reservation within 48 hours they were in place. You know, the overwhelming force aspect is in effect. So the locals, when queried often, are saying, well, it was those outside guys who did it, and they're trying to protect the, you know, basically their nieces, nephews, sons, daughters, whatever. So it was a very effective tactic.
Leonard Peltier had fled to Canada shortly after the incident. He was arrested and extradited to the U.S. based on fabricated evidence, including an affidavit from what he described as a psychologically compromised woman named Myrtle Poorbear. As she herself would later attest, Myrtle was made to fabricate a story about how she was Leonard's girlfriend and that she had heard him talk about how he had orchestrated to murder the two agents. While these proceedings were taking place, two other AIM members were also implicated in the deaths of the two FBI agents and were being tried for the crime in Peltier's absence.
Meanwhile, they had captured Butler and Robidoux separately, one in Kansas, one in South Dakota. And they had two of the three, so they went to trial in Cedar Rapids. Okay, and the charges against them are the same charges against Leonard Peltier. They're, in effect, his co-defendants. But they're being prosecuted first because they're available for prosecution, and the feds want to get some motion on this while Peltier's still sitting in Ocala, and you got this indefinite period before he's going to be coming back. Okay? Now, they presented the argument about this being a conspiracy and to lure the agents into the trial, all the rest of it. You had a judge there that allowed considerable latitude in the development of a self-defense argument. Nobody said. Bob and Dino, neither of them said that they did not participate. In fact, Bob, to all intents and purposes, said, I killed them both.
Mm-hmm. Okay?
Both were mortally wounded by large bore, .44 caliber, in fact. That's a pretty big weapon. He said, I was the only one using a .44 Magnum during a firefight. Another guy had it. He was a lousy shot, and I'm not, so I took it away from him, and I used that. Bob said, I did. I was the one, in effect, who killed him, and I would do it again because of the way the FBI was comporting itself. And you had the defense called people from the U.S. Civil Rights Commission who had investigated what was happening on Pine Ridge and the FBI director himself. Upshot was the jury determined that under the conditions that had been created by the FBI, it was the only reasonable course of action to defend themselves against the attack. And they were acquitted on the basis of having acted in self-defense reasonably. So this leaves Leonard Peltier as the only possible conviction. And if you look at Peltier's case, once they got him back down here, that whole conspiracy notion had gone away. And he was prosecuted on the basis of being lone gunman.
Yeah.
Well, I would submit to you that it's at least plausible. I don't believe it's true in either instance, but it's at least plausible that the federal prosecutors believed that there was a conspiracy. Or they believed there was a lone gunman. But they presented both cases, and they couldn't possibly have believed both.
Mm.
So you had this knowing tailoring of the facts in one or both cases. I would argue in both cases. And they were not successful the first time, and they really went about tailoring things. They went judge shopping, and they had the entire trial record from Cedar Rapids declared inadmissible as evidence in court again during the trial against Peltier, so that agents, for example, J. Gary Adams, who was present at on site at the time, he was the first agent that tried to go in after the firefight had begun, and he took fire and retreated and hid in a ditch until it was all over. And felt guilty about it, apparently, because these were his two friends that were getting killed while he hid in a ditch. Okay, he testified to one set of facts at Cedar Rapids and a completely different set of facts of what he had observed against Peltier, and the defense was disallowed by the judge from impeaching his testimony based upon his prior testimony. You see how this worked. Completely different case, the same set of facts presented against Peltier would have been unsuccessful in Cedar Rapids against Butler and Robidoux. So that was a railroad job from start to finish. Yeah. And you've had jurors have said since, if we had been aware of this at the time, we would have voted the opposite, you see. So they had a very cooperative judge, you could say, Paul Benson, that resulted in Peltier's conviction.
And yet, and, we've seen over the years...
The evidence that was presented, the physical evidence is absurd, and even the Eighth Circuit Court has arrived at that conclusion. Mm. And I can't remember, and the last appeal that went to the Eighth Circuit Court, the three-judge panel, this is in the mid-'80s, 1985, I believe, three-judge panel of the Eighth Circuit Court that heard Peltier's appeal, headed by William Webster, who wasn't even there to issue the opinion because he'd already become appointed director of the FBI. So he handled the appeal despite knowing he now had this inherent conflict of interest, big-time conflict of interest. You know, Judge Haney, who read out the opinions that, you know, the record demonstrates significant misconduct on the part of the FBI. But to remand this for a retrial would impute even further misconduct, and this we're reluctant to do.
Hmm.
Which is the same as saying if this was any ordinary case, this would have, the verdict would have been thrown out right then and there on the basis of what was known about the manipulation of evidence and so forth, shell casings and such. You know, they would have gone back to trial, and probably you'd have had a different outcome.
There have been multiple appeals, though.
In this case, he stays in prison rather than tarnish the reputation of the FBI.
So, yeah. So, I mean, does this the fact that the FBI – I mean, the FBI, it's in their own interests. I mean, regardless of considerations of justice, it's in their interests to keep Leonard Peltier behind bars until he dies, essentially.
Oh, very much in their interest, but it's a broader interest that's served by that, too. And in a way, their interest is served by it being known that he was flat-out railroaded, falsely convicted, that they orchestrated this as a consequence for basically standing on his rights and not equivocating. And the message is, if you do that, if you make yourself aware of your rights and you refuse to relinquish them when you're instructed to do so, there are consequences. Mm. Here's the consequences. Okay? If you don't want to end up like Leonard Peltier, do what you're told.
Mm. Now,
and the more it's obvious that he is framed, railroaded into this position and sitting in a cage as a result of his political attitude, you know, the better it is from their point of view in conveying that message. And the only way to counter that message, of course, would be to get him out. Well, actually, rephrase that, it would have been, haven't been able to get him out earlier. Say in the mid-1980s when the court determined that it was a bogus case, but left him in prison anyway.
So would you say that
the Supreme Court, incidentally, refused twice on two separate appeals. Found reversible error 13 times in the initial appeal, but failed to reverse. The U.S. Supreme Court declined to review the matter and let that stand. And then you have this, with the court itself saying the FBI, the record is fraught with FBI misconduct. And we have, it was a Bagley decision. We had two different standards for reversing cases in two different appellate courts. That's exactly the sort of thing Supreme Court is supposed to resolve when you've got conflicting standards between federal districts.
Mm-hmm.
They declined that one, too. So,
yes, and as well, President Clinton went back on a promise to have him released, presumably.
Well, Clinton went back on a promise to have him released. Clinton's Clinton.
Yeah.
you know, he's purely an opportunist, but he was basically informed by the FBI, you can do this. We can't stop you. Okay, but if you do, you'll be under FBI investigation on stuff like Whitewater and so on for the rest of your life. Or you can not do it, and we'll just basically leave you alone.
Seen kind of a whispers of resistance in the form of Occupy Wall Street and Black Lives Matter, and I'm wondering what lessons can be learned that might feed into a vibrant resistance. How can we avoid what's happened to the Black Panthers and the American Indian movement moving forward?
Well, consciousness is the first thing, and I've been working on that all my adult life. I mean, I was personal friends with Mark Clark, who was one of the, I mentioned it earlier, the Hampton Clark assassinations in Chicago in 69. So I've been working on this with a personal interest of that sort ever since. Being aware of it and how it works and why it works that way is the first thing. Know your enemy, I suppose. Have an actual understanding of the structural realities we're up against. So rather than just having this gut reaction to this isn't fair, this isn't right, this is wrong, we need to change it, have some real concrete understanding of what it is you're trying to change and consequently how it would need to be changed, where you're going, and so on. Okay. You mentioned two recent phenomena, one of which I find very encouraging, the other of which not so much. and not so much in was Occupy, because deliberately vacuous nature of analysis. Not that they're wrong about the 1%, although I would extend it a little further than 1%. Framing it 1 versus 99 is a good rhetorical flourish in an initial level, but you can't seriously argue, if you're going to do organizing in more oppressed communities, that they're in the same boat as some guy who's only making about $1.5 million a year. Okay, because he's not a member of the 1%. He's part of the 99%. And they actually had this really stupid, in my view, sort of rule in this rule-free organization that you really couldn't highlight the conditions in any given community versus any other, because that would be divisive. Well, that actually was divisive. That vacuous sort of premise that you can't talk about specific Indian issues of the sort that we've been talking about, because that would divide them away from the settler population that would might feel bad. It was kind of maybe in a superficial sort of way heartening to see large numbers of people coming out in opposition. But it was going to go nowhere. It was going to go nowhere based upon what I was saying. That's my take on that. Black Lives Matter is much more promising, but they got to get beyond, well, several things, and we'll say they might. But one, in the context of what we're talking about today, you know, blacks are actually not the most frequently, young black men actually are not the most frequently killed by police. American Indians are. Blacks tend to get killed by cops with dash cameras and stuff in urban areas where there's more of a possibility there's going to be media exposure on it. Indians tend to get killed more often in rural areas by somebody whose department doesn't really concern itself with things like dash cams and so forth, because there's no pressure. And so it goes. But proportionately, the rate is higher for Indians than it is for blacks. And I'm not making an argument as to who's the most oppressed. Well, I am making an argument that that's worth consideration. That it ought to at least be mentioned and taken into the calculus. But we always talk about, quote, minorities as being black and brown, and sometimes they include Asians. Indians aren't even on the list.
Yeah.
I may be a little different in Canada, depending on what part of Canada you're in particularly. But that's the reality down here. And that consciousness has to change for the movement to be successful. Otherwise, you get so-called liberation of various oppressed communities, all predicated upon ongoing colonization and oppression of American Indians. And that's just colonialism continued. Change forms someone. Well, I'm not especially interested in talking about a better or worse form of colonialism. As far as I'm concerned, colonialism and oppression are colonialism and oppression, and it doesn't really matter who's administering that.
Okay. Well, Ward Churchill, I've really appreciated this conversation. I know we've touched on some very important realities facing the people of all different persuasions, all different colors, and I want to thank you for sharing those insights with us.
Thank you.
Okay.
It's my pleasure.
Okay.
Or not, but it was my privilege, I suppose.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yes, sir. Take care.
Take care. On January 10th, an MRI confirmed that Leonard Peltier suffered from abdominal aortic aneurysm, placing his life in jeopardy. The International Leonard Peltier Defense Committee is urging supporters to contact the Federal Bureau of Prisons to demand timely treatment for Peltier, as well as a transfer to a suitable medical facility. The ILPDC is also renewing the call for presidential clemency by President Barack Obama so that Peltier can spend the rest of his remaining years as a free man. For details, visit www.whoisleonardpeltier.info. That concludes this week's edition of the Global Research News Hour. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. Many thanks to our partners across Canada and the United States, as well as to the website globalresearch.ca and the Progressive Radio Network, which podcast our shows. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. Thanks again for joining us.